I just want to check with CHE whether CHE will be able to present after SAPTU if the other presenters are not here, so that we make a move and don't get stuck in the process. So you'll be able to present. Thank you very much. Thank you for your understanding. So if UCT is not here, by the time UCT, will you be in a position to present, or do you have to wait for the Vice Chancellor? All right, no, that's fine. If the Vice Chancellor is here, and if he is not here, we'll then proceed with CHE, and then you come after CHE. Is that okay? All right, thank you very much. Well, honorable members, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to welcome the honorable members of the Portfolio Committee, the stakeholders that will be presenting on the Higher Education Amendment Bill, such as the South African Parastatal and Tertiary Institution Union, University of Cape Town, Higher Education Transformation Network, Council on Higher Education, and the Catholic Institute of Education. Allow me to also welcome the media, members of the public, and other distinguished guests. The South African Constitution sets the need for realization of participation democracy, which calls for active involvement and participation of the citizenry in legislative processes of Parliament. Section 59 and subsection 1 of the Constitution states that the National Assembly must facilitate public involvement in the legislative and other processes of the Assembly and its committees. Today, I would like to report that we have received 15 submissions from a wide variety of stakeholders, which is fundamental in the public involvement. And we see this as in sync and aligned to the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa. Of importance is that some key stakeholders have acknowledged that they were consulted by the Department of Higher Education and Training during the review process, and we regard this as work in progress. Well, the public hearings conducted by the committee today are in compliance with the constitutional directive. The input by all the stakeholders of the bill will be considered by the committee during the deliberation phases of the bill. But key that I would like to raise to the honorable members is that today our role is to listen, and listen carefully, and ask clarity-seeking questions. After receiving all the oral submissions, as this committee, we will have an opportunity to deliberate on the matters raised. So we will listen, ask clarity-seeking questions. At a later stage, when we received all the submissions, oral submissions, then we will deliberate, engage, deliberate, and have vigorous debates on these matters until we arrive at a sufficient consensus. Thank you very much. With these few words, I welcome you and hope we will have a constructive engagement. I will now call upon the South African Parastatal and Tertiary Institutions Union on the higher to present to us on the Higher Education Amendment Bill. Over to you.
Madam Chair, thank you for giving us this opportunity. I'm Advocate Ben Vanhoof. I'm the secretary to our union, which is the South African Parastatal and Tertiary Institutions Union, We are very well settled in the university field in South Africa as a recognized trade union, also registered with the Register of Labor Relations. What we did say in our submission, and I want to say that we've requested Professor Derek van der Merwe, sitting on my left here, who is an emeritus professor of law at the University of Johannesburg and also an independent consultant, to draft us our submission and submit it to you. So I would very much like to give Professor van der Merwe the chance to put a case before you.
What can you say?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to make comments on the amendments bill. Madam Chair, I am assuming that the opinion that I prepared for sub 2 has been provided to the members of the portfolio committee, and I will therefore not be rehashing what I have already put on paper. I merely wish to make a few prefatory remarks. The first is that my comments have been made from the perspective of a member of a trade union like sub 2, who is concerned at the impact that the proposed amendments might have on her employment at a higher education institution. The comments that I have prepared have taken into account two basic principles. The first, which is also found in the preamble to the Higher Education Act, and that is the desirability for higher education institutions to enjoy freedom and autonomy, but to do so within the context of public accountability. Clearly, therefore, Madam Chair, there is a balance that needs to be maintained between institutional autonomy, academic freedom, on the one hand, and public accountability on the other. Our contention is that in three respects, we believe that the proposed amendments tilt the balance too heavy in favour of public accountability to the extent that it is potentially at the cost of and to the detriment of institutional autonomy. That, therefore, is the first guiding principle on the basis of which we compile the points. The second is the principle that it is very important, it is necessary, that potential intrusions into the institutional autonomy of higher education institutions on the premise of public accountability should happen within a context where such intrusions can be raised, can be justified, can be debated against established laws and legal principles. And in fact, law should rule both for the minister and his or her department and for the higher education institutions. So those are our two basic assumptions, Madam Chair. Then you will see from my opinion that we have acknowledged that a great deal of work has gone into the preparation of these amendments. A ministerial task team comprising stakeholders in the HE sector did an initial draft. Thereafter there was a range of stakeholder engagements. Importantly, on more than one occasion, with what we believe to be the most important of the stakeholders, namely ESA, which is now called Universities South Africa. So we recognise that a lot of work and a lot of good work has been done, and that many, indeed most, of the proposed amendments are necessary for the effective functioning of the higher education system. In three respects, Madam Chair, we wish to voice our concerns. The first is in respect of the proposed insertion of a clause that provides the Minister with the power to set transformation goals for the system and to institute appropriate oversight mechanisms. Secondly, the ministerial directives are a first phase in the appointments of independent assessors and administrators for public higher education institutions. And thirdly, the onerous administrative burden that the proposed amendments will place on higher education institutions. As far as the first is concerned, the transformation goals and oversight mechanisms, Madam Chair, a proposed new section 3.3b stipulates that the minister, in the interests of higher education, of the higher education system as a whole, can determine transformation goals for the higher education system and institute appropriate oversight mechanisms. This is the only section that deals with transformation goals and appropriate oversight mechanisms. The assumption we therefore make is that the detail will be provided in subordinate legislation, in regulations that the Minister is empowered to make in terms of Section 69E of the Act. Concerns us directly, Madam Chair, is an over definition of provided for the terms transformation goals, oversight mechanisms, appropriate oversight mechanisms. Given the definitional vagueness that attaches to the term transformation and the strong passions and emotions that this term evokes in popular discourse, one would have expected some context to be given in the Act and not to wait for subordinate legislation. One does not know who exerts oversight, what the powers of those individuals will be, and what the minister will do once she or he receives an adverse report. The setting of transformation goals, while obviously in the cause of public accountability, is potentially intrusive. Transformation, narrowly defined in higher education, refers to matters such as employment equity targets, racial and ethnic composition of an institution's student body as a whole or with reference to its subordinate parts. Race-based past throughput graduation rates, race-based profiling of institutional or national research outputs. The transformation, Madam Chair, also refers to a lot of other things. It refers to curriculum reform, to pedagogical reform, to epistemological transformation. It refers to performance evaluation, to academic excellence. The institutional transformation plan, the ITP, that all institutions were expected to provide to the Department of Higher Education Training, reflects, in the view of Professor Clare Sedin, a very wide spectrum of meanings that are attached to the term transformation. We therefore cause concern to subject that this very important but also very emotive term and the oversight mechanisms the minister has become or will become empowered to use to enforce transformation goals lacks definitional precision. Therefore, in order for an institution to be able to engage with the minister on transformation goals, on the justifiability of the potential intrusion into institutional autonomy that really goes to the heart of the academic enterprise, one expects that the scope, the nature, the impact, the execution of these goals, these oversight mechanisms, should be spelled out in the Act and not, one assumes, reduced to status of regulation. We have, Madam Chair, taken the liberty of proposing certain making certain proposals to meet the objections which we have. The first matter is to simply withdraw the proposed new section 3.3.d. The minister currently has the right to make policy on higher education. Transformation, oversight over transformation is very much a policy issue. Indeed, he can do so without the necessity of an amendment as currently formulated, without even making reference to transformation as such. Equity targets can and have been set. Profile of students at different institutions do take place, and universities are happy to participate in the process, etc. Our second proposal is an obvious one. Please give context to the transformation goal, oversight mechanism. Oversight has no legal definition. We don't know what oversight actually means. What is an appropriate mechanism? Currently, as it stands, the minister determines what is appropriate. The third proposal, Madam Chair, is that we believe that in the spirit of a co-governed higher education system, it is very important that if Parliament deems it appropriate that transformation goals should in fact be inserted in the legislation, that the setting of these goals should then be consulted with the council or management of each institution. But the oversight mechanism that the minister wishes to set in place should take place with the concurrence of university councils. So that would allow the appropriate give and take between a minister whose responsibility it is to ensure that institutions are held to public account on the one hand, and on the other hand, universities who wish to pursue their goals within a framework of institutional autonomy can do so with the constant consultation of the minister and the concurrence of the minister. The second concern we have, Madam Chair, is with the ministerial directives, the clauses, the new sections referring to ministerial directives, and the follow-through to that, the appointments of independent assessors and administrators. Now, we acknowledge that a lot of hard work has obviously gone into the drafting process to make sure that this potential inclusion into institutional autonomy is framed within concepts of reasonableness, and that the work of an independent assessor and an administrator is that there is a range of detail that will prevent her or him from overstepping the bounds of just and fair administrative action. So, by and large, we do not have the problem that the minister will act in an arbitrary fashion when considering the issuing of a directive or when eventually appointing an independent assessor. The issue that we wish to highlight to this portfolio committee, Madam Chair, is that six grounds are listed on the basis of which the minister may decide after a process has been undertaken to nevertheless issue the directive, I mean, flowing from directive, an independent assessor may be appointed. One of those is wrong. The other five one may or may not quibble with, but the one particular ground is the one that we are concerned with. And this is that, as stated in the proposed 42.1c, that the minister, if he has or she has reasonable grounds to believe that the council or management has acted in an unfair, discriminatory or wrongful manner towards a person to whom owes a duty under this act or any other law. Now this, we propose, should be read with 42.2b, which says that the minister, in his directive, in his or her directive, must state why such actions have a negative impact on the institution in an open and democratic society. Also, the appointment of an independent assessor must be in the best interest of the public higher education institution concerned. It's our contention, Madam Chair, that this sequence of actions provides ample opportunity for the intrusion of political ideology into the decision-making process. To be sure, what is unfair or discriminatory or wrongful must be measured against the duty imposed by the Act or any other law. Our submission, Madam Chair, is that this does not provide sufficient defence against politically motivated intrusion by a minister. What counts as unfair or discriminatory in the higher education context is still an open question in law. We have clarity on law, on procedural fairness, on fair or unfair labour practices, but fairness or discrimination within higher education is as yet fairly untested terrain in our jurisprudence. This is so, Madam Chair, particularly if one notes that the nature of the unfairness or the discrimination must be measured against the negative impacts in an open and democratic society. Now, what an open and democratic society is quite frankly the business of Parliament. And it's a contested terrain. It is the terrain for political ideology. How open is open? It's a question Karl Popper has been posing since the 60s. What is a democracy? So, what we are saying, Madam Chair, is that we acknowledge that all of these must be measured against the acts or the duty imposed by the acts or by any other law. But in our submission, it still leaves the door very widely open. It allows the minister to declare a particular institution's policies to be unfair or discriminatory if an institution denies access to a person on the grounds of language, of academic exclusion, of financial exclusion. These are the three most obvious domains within which the minister might deem an institution's policies to be unfair or discriminatory or wrongful. And our contention is that there is much in here for political maneuvering. This is based on perceptions of what is fair or unfair, is discriminatory or not, in the context of a contested domain such as the openness and the democratic nature of our society. We have a proposal that might meet the objection here raised, and that is to delete the terms unfair and discriminatory, simply refer to wrongful conduct. Wrongful conduct includes conduct that is unfair or discriminatory. Importantly, by simply referring to wrongful conduct, it demands from the minister that her or his powers be exercised within the context of established law. We all know, lawyers pretend to know what wrongfulness is. It's a concept that has a context, proven context. And secondly, it allows the exercise of the ministerial powers to be tested in an independent legal forum against the background of established legal principles. The rule of law should govern, we contend, both ministerial action in promoting public accountability and institutional action in serving the interests of institutional autonomy. The third and final ground, Madam Chair, is that the proposed amendments place a very onerous administrative burden on higher education institutions. It now gives the Minister the power not only to oblige an institution to furnish information in respect of a preceding year, but any information. So it could be in respect of the current year, it could be in respect of years past. And the type of information is not specified. Either of these will obviously be specified in the regulations, but it can place a very, very onerous burden on an already burdened administrative staff complement. Equally, although we fully acknowledge the need to regulate against corruption, promotion of individual self-interest in employment situation within publicly funded higher education institutions, the proposed amendments now make it compulsory for all employees of public higher education institutions to declare business, commercial, financial interests undertaken for financial or other gain. And to do so not only when the employment commences, but to do so on an annual basis or whenever such an interest might crop up. Madam Chair, this is a massive, massive burden. When I was involved at the University of Johannesburg, we had to comply with the current provision in the Act. It was a lot of work. It was a lot of work, and there is really no guarantee other than a very thorough, painstaking policing of each individual's account of her activities, financial activities outside of the institution, to be sure. Then, Madam Chair, mea culpa from my side, in the opinion, I make the point that there is no definition given to relative, of course, definition, I disagree with that, I'm really sorry. The point, though, made that to do so not only for the employee, but also for her or his relative as defined, increases the burden so much more. And it's not to wonder whether this is all worth it. There are thousands of employees in public higher education institutions. To expect an institution on an annual basis to keep a repository of information on business activities, business or related activities, direct or indirect financial gain, is a huge burden. And we wonder whether such a burden of fighting corruption and fighting individual self-interest should not be properly left to the councils and the managements of each public higher education institution. Those are the points that we wish to raise, Madam Chair. We thank you again for the opportunity of being able to formulate them. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was a presentation by the South African Parasitical and Fishery Institutions Union. I will now open for clarity-seeking questions by the honourable members. Honourable Member Martha and Honourable Member Ketana, in that order.
Thank you.
In Chilean, we follow Honourable Member Ketana. Thank you, sir, for interrupting you.
Thanks, Jim. I just have one clarity on your historic analysis of what could go wrong if things were to be allowed the way they are proposed. Don't you think maybe the reasons for these amendments are informed by the history of what has turned out to be the slow pace, the inability by higher education institutions to self-correct and self-correct over time? Because should we have had a situation where there was clear guidance and leadership on all the issues substantially that you have raised, we would have never landed ourselves here. I think the way the act was, even in amended versions of it, I think it was very careful on Dr. Campbell as it did before. But then we sit now, 10 years later, after the amendment, and things are getting slow. There is much more difficulty in even knowing when will universities even realize the transformed state of the South African university. We don't even know that. It was supposed to be natural for universities to self-direct. And don't you think maybe this preoccupation led us here?
Madam Chair, through you, a quick response. Many universities have self-directed in our view. Many universities have done what was expected of them. There are those, we acknowledge that with self-direction, to use your phrase, honourable member, has not had the requisite impact. Our concern is that this is a broad brushstroke. Now, the entire system, each university will be expected to promote transformation goals set by a minister and as currently formulated. There's no guidance to the institution on what those goals are in respect of which matters they are. And on the face of it, where no consultation, no engagement need take place between the minister and the councils. Nobody can deny, it would be church to deny, that things are in the manner in which one deals with that. Our proposal is that it's not the closed fist approach which the current proposals make. It's the open hand that we should have.
Thank you very much, but on a procedural matter, I would like us to take all the questions and then head over to you to respond to all the questions.
My apologies.
That's okay. All right. Well, thank you very much. Shall we then move over to Honourable Member Kinano?
Professor, on the definition of transformation, which you very strongly emphasize, and in the feedback you did define it about whether it's about curriculum, about student racial transformation, and what I don't understand is that you seem to have a very good in a broad sense understanding what transformation is, because transformation is nothing material other than just changing our society. And also our society is no material thing. We know from where we come from. So when you change it for a better society, in a democratic society that will be integrated and have a nation rather than many nations within the nation. And I was surprised that you defined it when you were outlining it about curriculum, about students, about the core content, you seem to have a very good grasp of what transformation is all about. Now you are a professor and an academic. I know you like the exercise of debating concepts and so on. But the point is, for example, on the issue of balance of autonomy and public accountability, I mean, these are not changeable. You know, if you are measuring bits and you can say 10 kilometers, you go in a set, put it on the scale and you see 10 kilometers. I mean, 10 kilograms. But these are abstract concepts. I mean, how do you accurately measure autonomy vis-a-vis public accountability? In other words, those that favor transformation or autonomy will always feel treated unfair when they are challenged that there's no enough transformation. And but I don't see how in an aggregate defined, given how broad these things are, everything like transformation, I don't know what the who will ultimately the side of it will be. But it looks like, broadly speaking, we all understand. And if this overlap or misunderstanding, I'm sure that can always be cleared in courts of law, whose job is always to finally interpret what is right and wrong. But really, I just don't understand why. I know there can always be a dispute with those that don't like transformation about what it means. Those that don't like oversight, they'll always want special issues. But you know, it's parliament that do, government that do oversight. And oversight is just there to go and check whether things are implemented, changes are implemented. But also say one definition of oversight. For me, it's like we really don't want to. It's because we just don't like oversight, transformation, public accountability, all the concepts. I just want you to explain it further. Otherwise, for me, it's like an attitude and finding an excuse not to embark on the concept.
Thank you for the clarification question from Honorable Member Kehana. I will now call upon Honorable Member Killian. And after Honorable Member Killian, it will be Professor Kogoli.
Thank you, gentlemen. Jesus, I would like to ask a question about the concerns with regards to the directives that the Minister will be able to issue. Now, according to the current Act, Section 42, there is actually a provision for intervention by the Minister, which goes to the Council of, well, there is consultation with the Council of Higher Education. The proposal in the bill obviously elaborates further and is an attempt to clarify different phases of such intervention, as we understand. And please just help us understand. Now, if the concern of subject is about political, ideological issues that can creep in, and they not creep in currently under the current provisions, because clearly there is consultation with the CHE, but it is only consultation. The Minister still has the authority to do what he has, and he has the responsibility to make sure that the sector develops. So that is my first one. What is the real concern? Is it because SAFTU is representing a specific sector within the higher education? You know, it's a union representing specific people, and consequently it would have impact on, you are concerned, at least certain equity targets are set, that it would affect your union members. So is that the real concern that you have? Secondly, Chair, you will allow me. If I look, you are speaking about, your suggestion is that we should look at the word wrongful instead of unfair discrimination. The issue that I have is, all words have is a matter for interpretation. If we look at the equality clause in the Constitution, it clearly describes Section 9.3. States may not unfairly discriminate directly or indirectly against anyone on one or more grounds, including race, gender, sex, etc., etc. Now, is the constitutional provision not adequate protection that whatever the minister is doing, there must be due process, he must give adequate notice to the institution, they have adequate time to respond positively, to correct whatever is wrongful. So why would the word make a difference? Would the wording make a difference if we in any case operate within a constitutional framework? Chair, I think those would be my input at present. I would just like to have, I think that's all for now. Thank you.
Thanks for your clarity questions, Honourable Member Killian. I will now call upon Honourable Member Professor Kozoli.
Thanks. Just to look at your, thank you very much for an excellent presentation. Which I don't think at all was offensive, but was very insightful as to the need to balance autonomy and responsibility, which is exactly what the minister said he's setting out to do here. So I think we're on the right terrain. In your point 56.3, you say your third suggestion as to how to fix the very vague, which, by the way, is an unacceptable flaw in a legal, in a law, is to be vague. Is it not an unacceptable thing to be vague in law? Laws must not be vague. So the vagueness is clearly a problem that does need to be addressed. And you're saying transformation goals should be determined by the minister in consultation with university councils and all university management, and that appropriate oversight measures should be determined by the minister with the concurrence. Is that not what's happening at the moment? Because each university does have a transformation plan. I presume it is agreed by council and management. So I'm not sure whether that would meet the requirements that the minister seems to be being worried about. And I wonder why you had not mentioned the role of council on higher education, which, although it doesn't seem to be claiming that role, in fact, by definition, in the way it was set up, it was designed as a body to oversee crucial elements of how universities were working, including transformation. So you have a body there whose job is to oversee these things already. Surely your proposal fully could therefore have included a reference to the Council on Higher Education as an additional body to look at these things,
besides
the ones that are already there.
Thank you. On definitional vagaries, Member Khanna, in the 1960s, the United States Supreme Court judge was seized with a matter on pornography, and in his judgment he said, I note when I see it, but I can't define it. The same probably holds true of concepts like transformation and public accountability. I would venture to suggest that no sector of our society has devoted more intellectual endeavor on the issue of transformation than academia. There are reams and reams of documents on transformation, what it means, how we can slowly begin to construct a definition of transformation. So a lot of work has been done in that sphere. The same holds true for public accountability. The same holds true for institutional autonomy. It is ourselves, as members of the public, who bandy a lot of phrases, which, and in doing so, we encourage vagueness, whereas there should not be. All of us in this country must understand, appreciate transformation, what it means, why it is a good thing, why institutions publicly funded by the state should be accountable for the manner in which and the extent to which they transform. The issue for us is we do need clarity because the students demand that the curricula of universities should be decolonized and Africanization of the curriculum should take place. These are weighty issues. These are not the sorts of issues that a ministerial decree should determine. It should be a groundswell of students and academics in the universities constructing, pursuing, imparting knowledge, the manner in which they do it, the pedagogy involved in it, the epistemology involved in it. This is the heart of the academic enterprise. It is the terrain of academia. It's also about transformation. Undoubtedly it's about transformation. Performance bonuses are about transformation. You need a framework in our humble submission. And the balancing act, Member Connor, I would venture to suggest that inherent in the human condition, you balance this, that, and the other. It does bring me to Member Killian's question about why make a big thing about unfair, discriminatory, wrongful. They are, after all, words. And the word unfair and discrimination is far better placed in the Constitution than the term wrongful. And I grant you that, Member Killian. The problem, as I sought to indicate, is that within the higher education sphere, concepts of unfairness and discrimination in an open and democratic society are terms that have not yet been subjected to a rigid jurisprudential analysis. Now, obviously, the counter would be, well, let them then. But we're in difficult times at the moment in this country. We are in a situation where universities are under severe pressure, and the minister and the students and the public at large are seeking questions, quite legitimately so. And now is the time for us to work with concepts on which there is broad agreement. Open and democratic society is equally a cornerstone of the Constitution. But the content that we give to that is very much a matter for debate in this Parliament on a virtually daily basis when it's in session. And our plea on behalf of SOTU is, and on behalf of its members, for whom indeed our concern is that let's give our members who are currently in the universities, who are currently facing the brunt of the pressures, just give them at least the satisfaction that whatever is implemented within a framework that is recognizable and on the basis of which any disputes can be arbitrated, can be judged against accepted legal norms within the higher education context. Member Bozzoli, yes, the minister does consult. Yes, the member does see, as a minister does see concurrence, undoubtedly. I have personal engagements with the minister where he does go out of his way to consult to seek concurrence. The problem, of course, this is a law not for Militants of Monday, this is a law for whatever should happen in the future. And if there is already in practice consultation and concurrence, why not acknowledge it in the legislation? As far as the PhD is concerned, Member Bozzoli, I'm pretty sure the CIG will quite legitimately seek to impress their role in higher education. As a body representing our academic members, the immediate concern is the condition to service, the employment relationship between themselves and the institutions, and the role that their institutions can and should play. But we, as a union, have no doubt, no problem whatsoever, to insert the role of the CHE as prominently as it can and should be.
Well, thank you so much, Professor Anamevin, for the responses. But I must also thank the honorable members for the clarificatory questions that they have raised. I want us to move on to the next item, but before we do that, next presentation, but before we do that, we have received the following apologies.
Yes, we received apologies from Professor Mismang, as well as Professor Kolisa, as well as the Minister, the Deputy Minister, and the Chief.
We take note of these apologies, but also to mention that in our presence, we have State Law Advisor, Advocate Boshoff. We've got the Legal Advisor, V. Ngobozi, and we've got officials from the department, Dr. Parker and Mr. Patel, and the other members of the delegation. So shall we then proceed, but maybe we should then look at the presenters that have now joined us. Can they please introduce themselves? The presenters. Yes, if you have time to listen to the other presentations, you can sit and listen, but if you've got other work, you can be excused. Okay, yes. All right. Well, shall we then quickly introduce ourselves? Starting from...
Thank you, Honourable Member Porter. I'm Dr. Matt Crum. I'm the Vice Chancellor from the University of Cape Town. I do apologise if you were expecting me to be here earlier. I thought I only should be here for my presentation at 10.
No, thank you very much. The next presenter. I just want the presenters to introduce themselves. It's my way of checking whether all our presenters are here now, so that we don't make a mistake.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Dr. Ingrid Tufusam of the Higher Education Transformation Network.
Okay, thank you very much. So we now have all our presenters for now before she, and then later on we've seen Professor Mosia, and then Mr. Parsonsi, is he here? Yes, okay, thank you. We now have all our presenters. So the presentation will then flow according to the schedule that has been circulated. So the presentations now. In terms of the presentations, we are now on the second presentation by Dr. Prime. Now, I do want us to, again, listen. I want to invite the members to listen and listen carefully to the presentation and ask clarity-seeking questions. Thank you very much. Over to Dr. Price.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the portfolio committee. I can see that you're going to be hearing the same thing, some of the same things over and over, and I'm perhaps going to, because you have the text of our submission, I'm not going to repeat many of the arguments that are made, and I've heard some of them, so I hope I can be much shorter. I also want to make the point that the University of South Africa, which is presenting tomorrow, solicited the views of all the universities in preparing their presentation, and almost all of the submissions from the University of Cape Town are already incorporated in that, what you'll hear tomorrow, and will be elaborated in some ways in more detail. And what we would do is just need to signal, by way of making the submission directly, that we endorse those views, and in this presentation, just very briefly to make reference to them so that we don't, that the committee's time is not wasted. The points are really, does everyone have the documents? Can I, should I refer to it, Madam Chair?
Yes, it was circulated to the Honourable Member.
Right. So, starting point is that we welcome any aspects of law, and in general we think this will address the problematic conditions of the previous amendments. And we have been an integral part of helping craft those amendments with the department, and we are pleased with the direction this is taken. So the points that I'm highlighting are obviously the ones where we still have disagreements and differences. And the first relates to the proposed sections 2D and 3C, which grant the Minister additional powers in relation to transformation. Now we understand, firstly, that this is in response to the perceived slow pace of transformation, primarily. And we also concur, and perhaps this is slightly different from the previous presentation, concur that the Minister has a responsibility to ensure that the pace and scope of transformation is accelerated. The way that it's been phrased in the amendment is generally one in which we support, because it refers to transformation in the system of higher education. And a transformation in the system, we want to be sure, leads to different sorts of goals and directives from transformation goals for individual institutions. And so what we are endorsing is that phrasing and that presentation. And the system, because it is such a differentiated system and it is part of the white paper that it should be an increasingly differentiated system, it's going to have different kinds of goals at different levels, and institutions will be differentiated even in terms of these goals. And it's important, therefore, that the powers of the Minister should be at the system level in order to preserve, to maintain the balance of accountability and autonomy. Nevertheless, even then, at the system level, there are clearly all sorts of directives and goals that could be set, one could imagine, by a minister that was pursuing a particularly a political agenda or an ideological agenda, maybe at the maybe with less focus on the importance of the autonomy of universities, which would have an impact on individual institutions, which should. And that what the legislation currently does not do is it doesn't require the kind of public accountability, public consultation, and the role of the CHE to be fully entrenched in setting those transformation goals for the system. It leaves it to the Minister ultimately. And as previously you said, you may have the Minister in power today who shares the goals and for which there is no conflict or disagreement on such goals, but you may have a Minister in the future who does not. And unfortunately, the history of higher education in many African countries post independence has been a history of increased encroachment of political control of the university to great expense and detriment of the university. So we need to have a legislation that can protect the universities from that. So our proposal is that the power to determine transformation goals in institute oversight activism should be executed in consultation with the CHE. Not after consultation, but in consultation with the CHE. To make the point that when we are public institutions and we must be publicly accountable, that public is represented not just by a political party, one political party, or by one minister, but it's represented by many other constituencies as well. And so the mechanisms of that accountability, we think, are better achieved if the consultation with the CHO is a requirement and essentially the support of the CHE. We also think that other mechanisms of public consultation should be instituted, probably by the CHE, but it could be by the Minister or by the Cultural Committee, in order to set these goals. The second clause, the second section, relates to the clause on the recognition of prior learning and credit accumulation. This is quite technical. We think that it needs further work. It should again be dealt with in consultation, or after this one could be after consultation with the CHE. And I'm not going to say more about it because I suspect it's not very controversial. And this will be laid out in detail in USAF, in the University of South Africa submission. The third is the new landscape, the new categories of higher education institutions that are being proposed, specifically university colleges and higher education colleges, which are being proposed in Section 20 of that. Again, the USAF submission will go through this in more detail. What we would to say is that we think these are very interesting ideas, new categories. We would probably support them. We think it's inappropriate, however, that they arise without having gone through white paper, without having been discussed at a policy level, without kind of, this is a substantial change to the higher education landscape. And it's appearing in the Act as legislation without having been through the kinds of process you would expect of this scale of policy. Not, as I say, opposition to what we think is being suggested, but in the process of appearing in a way so quickly and boldly in the legislation, many issues have not been considered, such as the relationships with the TVET colleges and with the universities themselves. So our recommendation there is that more discussion is necessary about the proposed different institutional types before creating these tasks through the amendment law, and that should be left for a future amendment. Our fourth point relates to reference in the bill, for example, in Section 1M, to the TFMA, and implication, I think, that public higher education institutions are subject to the TFMA. They are not, and we think it's really important that there should be no hint or suggestion that they are, and therefore that should be omitted. The fifth point is the question of public higher education institutions' ability to invest their funds and their assets. Again, the USAF Commission spells this out in much more detail and suggests also the amendment that we would like to see. But as the law, as the amendment stands at the moment, we believe it would prohibit the investment in the university's own intellectual property and spin-out company, because those are forms of investment that are not listed amongst investments that are possible, and by implication, given the list, are not possible. So a university develops some technology, perhaps collaborates with the DST or DTI or TIA, Technology Innovation Agency, to set up a company to develop this intellectual property. The university therefore has an investment in that, as the Act stands, we think that is not possible, and therefore that should be amended. Point six is the discussion about the minister's ability to issue directives in response to a number of things. Probably, if I understood the previous submission, we take a different view in the sense that we think that the minister must be empowered to make these directives, and that mostly those are useful, that enable the minister to exercise his responsibility for ensuring that the individual institutions and the higher education system as a whole is stabilized when it has a wobble. And we think that the many clauses that are then following how these directives are implemented and what happens if they're not implemented are generally sound and actually protect the institutions, that they require counsel to be informed before action is taken, they give counsel the opportunity to respond, etc. So our concern is specifically with clause 42.1c, the one of only one of those clauses, and then the point that has been raised in that was earlier discussion about that the minister may issue a directive where there are reasonable grounds to believe that the council or the manager of the higher education institution is acting in an unfair, discriminatory, or wrongful manner towards persons to whom it owes duty under this Act or any other law. Our submission is that this law should be removed altogether, not amended, because any individual to whom it is treated in a manner by a higher education institution that breaches their rights in law or their rights in terms of equity, unfairness, or discrimination has recourse to law. And that is the vehicle we have in society which would make the judgment about whether someone has been unfairly treated when a public higher institution has a duty to treat them fairly. As the amendment currently stands, the minister is solely responsible for making the judgment about whether someone has been unfairly treated. And we envisage that this, if it is ever used, that it would lead to ongoing court cases, because there will be a dispute between the university, say, or there may be a dispute between the university and the minister about whether indeed it is acted in a manner that is unfair towards the individual. And that can only be resolved in court anyway. Should be any such, if the clause is to remain in any form, then there needs to be a clear independent mechanism for deciding, a neutral mechanism, a mechanism like a court or an arbitrator, but that decide whether the person has been unfairly treated. It doesn't seem to me that this is something that a minister can take on. So this is one of the most controversial clauses that we think needs to be removed. To give an extreme example, which, you know, one hopes is not contemplated, but once again, it's the possibility of a different minister who is much more determined to control universities. To give an example, one could imagine the council selecting a vice chancellor, or selecting another senior official, or even a professor, but let's just take the example of a vice chancellor. The selection process would normally be fairly confidential. I mean, there are transparent elements of it because, of course, people give public lectures, the CVs are in public, we know who's been considered. But the selection committee obviously has a confidential process in which it receives referee reports, it does interviews, and it has a confidential discussion, and it makes a recommendation which is then approved often by the Senate and the Council. If the minister has a view in terms of this clause, that in terms of a duty of equity, some other candidate should have been appointed, let's say in terms of employment equity legislation, then according to this amendment, the minister doesn't have to test that in any other forum. The minister can just issue a directive to say, you're not demonstrated your duty of equity towards the other candidate, and I'm instructing you to remedy that. It's an extreme example, but it's what the Act, the main Act currently allows. And it's an example of how that would lead to all sorts of future conflicts, and why we think it should not be there. So that area, in our view, has legal problems in terms of rule of law, but also has serious problems in terms of infringing the autonomy of universities. There are other mechanisms that can address that. Point seven, our submission. I'm not going to suggest it's very technical. It just suggests that universities should be allowed in their own set, in their own rules, to create other grounds for revoking degrees. Currently, the way the Act is written, the minister is written, it would restrict the grounds on which degrees can be revoked, and we think it's too limited. Again, there's an amendment proposed by the USAC. And last point, point eight, is that we don't understand why this has been inserted. We think the Act as it now stands is accurate. The current Act allows a higher education institution to offer a qualification that would normally be offered by a TVET, in other words, something to do with trades and occupations. But what this law now proposes is that it gives ministers the power to compel a public higher education institution to do so. And we think that that could be problematic for any higher public education institution. There could certainly be a consultation process, there could certainly be an incentivization through funding, but it should remain as was before, so that it's an enabling clause rather than a compelling clause. And I think here that I will stop there and take questions.
Thank you very much for the presentation, Dr. Price. I will now invite the honourable members to raise clarification questions on the presentation. Honourable Member Ketana.
The first one. Just at the beginning, when you say Yulisa is going to be presenting on multi-trade and theatre because they consulted with you, if I heard it correctly.
I think Professor Kalinda has an answer.
Honourable Member Kikana, I was referring to University of South Africa, which was previously called HESA, Higher Education South Africa, and is now called University of South Africa, and is the organisation representing the 26 universities. So they are making a petition tomorrow, and we might have the universities.
The other one, your point number six, I think the one that you're raising a big, I think, argument about the minister interviewing a university because there is discrimination, and you're suggesting that it should rather read as that being done by a court of law. My own understanding is that any institution try and have internal mechanism to resolve internal conflict. It is only as a last resort or at a time when the country themselves that you can imagine if every institution is a doctor and to cut for every little thing, women will come, she's appealing intellectually, therefore to cut without going to an internal hearing. I just think we're overstating our cause if we don't start by mechanisms within. I mean, like you're saying, obviously the minister, seeing this discrimination and this discontent, it will ultimately go to court. But in many cases, his decision about what has happened might be acceptable, and therefore you will say, I know that the formulation in our court of law cases that must go through. And I don't think there will be enough magistrates and judges if everything is taken to court. So this is to relieve, I think, the court, because many other decisions that the minister might be interviewing with might be acceptable to the university, and that way you relieve everything being taken to court. So I just thought that is something that is happening in a lot of institutions, and in the sense of the rationality is well accepted. The last point, this is about age. Can you just repeat it again? Because there's an issue that I wanted to raise.
And number eight refers to the higher education institutions do not normally offer qualifications for trade and occupation. That's offered by TVET colleges, to some extent also by the University of Technology. And we think the current law covers, is enabling, that allows universities to do so if they wish, and in negotiation with departments. The amendment gives the minister to compel a public higher education institution to offer such qualifications.
Okay, yes, what I understand it to mean, I could be wrong, what it is, it allows the minister to compel an institution of higher education to meet such a qualification. I don't see where the problem is. Our understanding now, especially with the emphasis that higher education is taking, that 40% must go to university of our society and 60% must go to TVET. In other words, TVET must do more practical, more training that is practical oriented. Like you've got, as you know, during the Industrial Revolution, apprenticeship, journeyman, and even later now, I hear that Japan has 750 high education institutions, and the majority of those are TVET, are technical colleges. So it looks like developed countries are training more people on practical. Because in any case, I hear one engineer needs about 8 artisans and 4 technicians. So the person who do both and that is usually technically trained, and many of them work under this guy who designs and do in the case of an engineer. So I don't see where your problem is, because doesn't it still say in a higher education, which is divided between universities and TVET, ministers and compel practical to be done by teachers and universities as a lesser percentage to go to university. This is what I know, it is very clear with this attitude. And I wouldn't be surprised if it's written something different, you know. Yes.
Thank you. Then for the clarity seeking questions, I will now call upon Honorable Professor Koroli.
Thank you.
Followed by Honorable Member Kaiming and Ms. Chile.
First thing is that I had not realized that the University College and Higher Education College idea suddenly appeared in this law. I had assumed that it had been clarified earlier in white paper, and so we do need some clarity from the department about that. This has not actually been discussed. Secondly, I think congratulations on your point about the assumption that the minister will always be benevolent. We cannot make law on that assumption. We have to make laws on the assumption that one day a really nasty minister, nastier than the minister in the London, might come in and do terrible things, and those terrible things will be quite legal. And I'd like to draw attention of people here to the fact that yesterday it was reported that the President of Nigeria had summarily fired 13 vice chancellors. And one can think that this kind of thing can start happening once the law, freedom of ministerial discretion is extended to the kind of extent we're beginning to see here. So, yeah,
those are my points. I take it that these are clarity questions, Prof. Okay. I know that this session is for clarity questions. We will have a session where we will engage vigorously on these matters.
So one more question.
Okay. As long as we can confine ourselves to clarity seeking questions so that we can make progress, and at the end I'll give you your time for deliberation. Thank you very much. The next one is Honorable Member Hadime.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. On 4.6, you raise an objection in 4.5 that the word unfair and discriminatory be deleted. I just want to clarify what is wrong with unfair or discrimination.
Member Hadimane, I'm told that the question that you've raised belongs to the previous speaker, so we will then skip this question. The next person, or do you have another question? None. Shall we then have Honorable Member Hidium?
Thank you, Chairman. I would like to pose the question. It's just a price conference, just inform us. The whole issue that I believe the bill tries to address is the fact of public accountability and how all our institutions of learning should each work together to achieve the goal to prepare our nation for the workplace. So the whole purpose of this bill is, now within this is this whole debate about institutional autonomy, academic freedom and public accountability. Now, how would UCT describe, would it be a proper balance to achieve all of this, to say that we have had 21 years into the new democracy, we have made some progress and we made good progress, but how would the rest of the challenges that we face, that our people are not going through adequate skills development and are not in the right institutions, etc. The fact that the whole system at present is incorrect in that the university sector is far too big and the college sector is really not performing equally to successful nations in the world. How would Dr. Price and the UCC describe what the minister's intervention ability should be to address this in such a way that it is creating a balance to provide academic institutions an opportunity to have their role in South Africa, but to also in the same breath say that if you want to have access to public funding, if we don't put you, well, it's not in the PFMA, I haven't seen it in any of the scheduled universities, but clearly there must be a mechanism for institutions to account for public money. So how would they do that? If you could perhaps just give us your idea. Secondly, Chairperson, the new landscape and the concerns. Yes, if Dr. Price raises a concern, my understanding and perhaps I'm wrong, was in, I looked at the white paper after I read UCC's presentation last week. And I was under the impression that the white paper is in fact putting out very clearly the landscape, where you have different colleges, the TVET sector, how it will play into it, the community colleges, etc. So why is it UCT's contention that there was not adequate public consultation? The white paper emanates from the green paper, extensive deliberations that took place over years, and just the concern about that, why they have come to that final conclusion. Thank you, Chair. I would have others, but I would rather stop here. Thank you.
Thank you for your questions. I will now ask Honourable Member Kasi.
Thank you, Chairperson. My question relates to point number 6 in the presentation by Dr. Price, particularly as it pertains to section 42.1d or section 42.1 in its entirety, section 42.1c in particular, which states the minister may issue a directive to a council, and particularly, and I know this has been discussed previously, had acted in an undiscriminatory or wrongful manner towards a person to whom it owes a duty under this act or any other law. Now my question is, and I've just heard the input that was made by Honourable Kekana on this matter as well, the question then is an understanding of UCT in this case, would the minister then be basically a judge in this instance, determining whether a law has been broken, or whether someone has had unfair action taken against them in terms of the law, and is it not an intrusion into the principles of justice towards individuals that are concerned or institutions concerned? And whether or not this particular section in itself would actually stand up in front of, for example, a constitutional court in terms of the interference in the course of justice, where an individual can determine that a law has been broken or not, and then issue a directive, and if the directive is not compliant with it, go and appoint an independent assessor or administrator, etc. So I just want to because I didn't get a full explanation in the presentation.
Thank you, Honourable Members, for the clarity-seeking questions. I'll now cross over to Dr. Price to provide responses or clarity to the issues raised.
Many thanks, Honourable Members. Honourable Kekana, started with this point, I probably wasn't very clear. I personally think that all of the internal mechanisms in an institution must be exhausted before one goes to court or outside the institution. So let's take an example just to make it more concrete. The example I gave, as it turns out, which was the appointment of a new person like a vice chancellor, would not apply, would not have internal mechanisms available because the person is not yet an employee. An applicant for a job who is unsuccessful has difficulty using internal mechanisms. They would not often have to go to the court. But let's take the much more common, let's say we have someone who is due to be promoted or applies to be promoted to a professorship. And there's a view in some universities that black academics have more difficulty being promoted to professorships than white academics. Now, I don't want to get into whether that's true or not. That isn't really important for the purpose of the argument. We would say what currently happens and ought to happen is that there are internal mechanisms that get exhausted first. There's an appeal first to the dean, maybe to the vice chancellor, then to the council. And if the person is really unhappy and thinks that after all those appeals they've still been treated unfairly, they could go to the CCMA or to a court. I'm not saying that they should resort to that immediately. In fact, they might choose to. But what this clause does is it says that if that person writes to the minister before they've used any of the internal mechanisms, the minister, or before they've gone to court or the CCMA, the minister can say, this institution has a duty of fairness and equity to this applicant for promotion. I am going to issue a directive to the university that they must promote this person to professor. And nothing in the current amendment constrains that power. Nothing requires the minister to test that in any other independent process. It's just the opinion of the minister is the only thing that counts in making judgments about whether the person has been unfairly denied promotion. And then the minister issues a directive to the council, and if the council doesn't agree, could actually end up suspending the council if you go through the whole chain of events. That is the same section of the Act which leads to what happens if the council doesn't adhere to this. I wasn't for one moment suggesting that we should all be running to the courts. What I was suggesting was that there are lots of mechanisms available, including the courts, and that those are the mechanisms which should be used, and that this doesn't add anything. What I was saying is that if the minister tried to use this clause, my guess is that he would find himself in court, and that he would add to the burden of the court, because, in fact, and this comes to Honourable Member Kipling's point, in fact, we believe it's unconstitutional. And so I was making two arguments. One is that it's wrong in law, and the second is that it infringes autonomy in a very serious way, which we shouldn't allow to happen, and is not necessary because the mechanisms exist. On the question of the QS, again, I think that I wasn't suggesting that the university should be interfering. I think that there's a very clear division in the post-school education system between the vocations and trades which are largely offered by the TVET and the diplomas and degrees which are offered by the university. And then there is certainly some overlap in the university of technology. Really what I'm saying is that that should be preserved. It's well respected, it's well understood. Occasionally a university wants to stray into that area, especially the University of Technology, because they have the capacity and they have the laboratories and they have the skills to do so, and they should be allowed to do that. And that should be encouraged because we need many more people to be trained with those skills. The current law allows that. What this addition does is it says the minister can come to UCT or to a VIT or a Forte and say, although you don't have anything to do with skills and occupations, and although you don't have the capacity to offer the kinds of qualifications that are below a degree, UC is not allowed in the current program qualification list to offer universities that are not degrees, but the minister can compel us to offer TVET-type qualifications. And we're saying, it doesn't make sense, we don't know why it's there. Maybe it should be motivated, but it's not motivated in the memorandum, maybe we could be persuaded. We just don't understand why that clause has been inserted. Professor Zoe made a number of comments which I think are comments and I can't answer, but my understanding, and I think got the white paper in front of me, is that the white paper makes reference to community colleges, but doesn't make reference to the two kinds of colleges that are in this Act, which are university colleges and higher education colleges. And so we don't really know what these animals are. The community colleges, as far as we know, are not going to be, for example, under the auspices of the university, whereas we understand these are going to be under the auspices of the university. So they seem to be fundamentally different things. But I think that the Department of Higher Education and Training, I'm sure, will answer that. The Chair dealt with Honourable Member Cuddy-Ming's comment or question. Honourable McKillian, you answered very broad set of questions about what I think the Minister should do. Much of which is within the realm of the Amendment Act, but let me just say that your focus first was on preparing people for the workplace and the necessary skills of the minister. And I think that universities must be held accountable for that. And I would suggest that, for example, one form of accountability would be what proportion of your graduates are employed, or training, but are employed within 18 months of graduating. So that's something that a department should do. The minister should hold us accountable for the quality of what we do, the relevance of our degrees. We do those surveys ourselves because we want to know, and it gives us feedback on whether we need to modify our qualifications. Very few other institutions do. And for the record, I have a platform, 95% of our graduates are in employment within 18 months of qualifying. Only 5% are still, unless they've chosen to study further. Only 5% have not yet found work. That's very high. That's very high. The national figure we think is around only 70%. In other words, about 60% of graduates are unemployed 18 months. Now, that's where accountability should be held to ensure we train people appropriately. The other important job of university is research innovation. So counting the number of patents that people are counting the stock companies, counting the publications to the extent that that is a measure of productivity and new knowledge, looking at the relevance of our research and whether they're addressing local problems. And these are things that we put into our annual reports to the department. We have to include in our annual report a research report, a teaching and learning report, and we also include a transformation report, and we also include a report on community engagement and social responsiveness, because these are how we are held accountable. So I think the mechanisms are there. Maybe there's the capacity to digest that, to reach the reporters, to get back to campuses and universities if they are not ready to bring, is not strong enough, essentially, because it's a lot of data. But it's also in the public domain, and others could take that responsibility. Another, we also ask about how do we ensure that there's accountability for that the money, the public money, is well spent. So again, of course, we all now, not only do we all have to have external auditors, but those external auditors have to be approved by and work with the public auditor, the Auditor General. And so how we spend and what we spend is, I think, carefully monitored. But that doesn't necessarily tell you that we're using the money well. It only tells you we're not embezzling it. To use money well, we should be looking at the efficiency of our output. So how long does it take for our students to graduate and what proportion graduate? And again, we deliver those statistics in our annual reports in May, and then the department has a management information system to track that. I think there could be better, more accountability in that regard. So there are different areas of accountability. I've just addressed a couple. Landscape more generally, yes, I think if what you're saying is that we need far more places for people to do the CBET type skills and further growth at the university level, we would agree that the priority is to grow the CBET skills, and as I understand it, that the ministers are clear about that, and we support that. That's where the real need is for our economy right now. Honouring the captain, I can see that I muddled 2 points, and if you'll just allow me to unmuddle them, one I didn't really address. So 4.21d is about the minister intervening if the university does something which doesn't comply with any law. The reason I've mentioned that one specifically, 42 ideas, we think that should be changed to say that it should be a substantial contravention of law. There are lots of minor contraventions, and we don't think it's appropriate for the minister to issue directives on all of these. I'm sure that's what we intended, but we think that 42.1d could be improved by saying that the minister's intervention is restricted to a substantial contravention or failure to comply with the law. 42.1c is issued to do with the experience around the duty to treat people equitably, unfair treatment, wrong treatment. And that's the clause which we believe should be deleted, because we think I've said that really previously. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Price. I'm checking if honourable members still have some more clarificatory questions, but this one I'm giving. Deliberately writing this one because honourable member said that I've got more questions. And considering the fact that in the next session I will not entertain clarity seeking questions, I may as well allow her to raise those questions. I think they will benefit all of us. Then, Honourable Member Gekan, then from there, we close this presentation. After the office by Dr.
Chairperson, actually, so that we can move on, I'm concerned I will withdraw my question because otherwise we are probably going to run out of time. So I will not proceed.
Honourable Member Gekan?
I wish I could also withdraw, but I, as a curious person, I'm sorry. The number 6 point I get. You know when I said internal mechanism should be exhausted before you go out to court? Actually, this is because in mind I do have this thing of autonomy of university through public accountability, which is the minister. And when we started with the professor right at the beginning, he said, as long as there's a strike, you strike a balance there. So let's assume there's a balance between autonomy of university and public accountability to the minister. Our thinking, in a sense, practically speaking, he becomes your internal mechanism because something that you can exhaust within the university for public accountability, you might call the minister first before it goes to court. Therefore, the importance of that point of him being part of the operation of the university, as a last resort, I'm not saying everything because indeed you must strike a balance between the university's autonomy and public accountability. It is not then that it is important in the act that this one be highlighted. Because indeed, just to emphasize, we really don't want to see you vice chancellor all the time. I mean, your core business is to educate. But to be appearing in court with cases for judges to adjudicate on, I think that would defeat the purpose. So, this thing of the minister editorial powers to help your internal mechanism before things go to court, don't you think is very important? Given the country that is transforming, I mean, the terrain of our life today is to change, and human beings just don't like changes. So it is a tough terrain, and as a result, it may not be easy, and these mechanisms at least are very important of intervention.
Thank you, Honourable Member Kikan. Over to you, Dr. Price.
Thank you. We are very conscious of needing to provide mechanisms that avoid going to court. So if I could just give one more example, at our university we have an ombud. The ombud reports to the council, not to me. And the ombud entertains between 200 and 400 visits a year from people who have one or other sort of grievance, concern, dispute. I think we are certainly conscious and try very hard to find alternative dispute resolution mechanisms, avoid the court, and find ways of ensuring that people are treated fairly. That's clearly the obvious job. There are also things like whistleblowing lines. What we are concerned, and we wouldn't have a problem if the Act gave, the amendment gave, access. In a way, everyone has access to the minister in one way or another. No one can stop someone from writing to the minister and say, I have a grievance. And what the minister does is the minister writes to us. And we address it. We try to address it. We have a meeting with the minister, and the minister will think we've addressed it appropriately or not. We don't want to close down that avenue either. But what the amendment is saying is that if the minister has reasonable grounds to believe that the council has acted in an unfair manner, then he may show directly to the council. And so he or she becomes the judge, the final decision maker about whether the council has acted unfairly or not, and tells the council what to do about it. And we think that the minister, doubtless, would have the capacity to cope with that, but we think that that just leads to a very subjective and personal approach to addressing what is a highly contested area of fence, and that it would not end up being not be sustainable within our legal framework and other framework. Thank you, Manager, and thank you, Honourable Minister.
Well, Honourable Member, we come to the end of this presentation and the engagement by Honourable Members. Thank you very much, Dr. Price, for the clarity that you have provided, and also thank you, Honourable Members, for the questions that you have raised. We will then move on to the next presentation. Dr. Price, because this is a public meeting, meaning that if you have time, you can sit and listen, but if you don't have time, we understand. You're excused. Thank you very much. So we will then call upon Dr. Tudson, I don't know if I pronounced it correctly. Thank you very much, to give a presentation representing Higher Education Transformation Network. Over to you, Doctor.
Thank you, Chief. Technology before I'm moving on to will you leave this? Chief, Madam Chair.
Are you ready?
I am. I think we might have a bit of a glitch, but with your indulgence, we'll get through it. Chief, Madam Chair, Honourable Members, my co-presenters and sisters. Kegangan, will permit me the HETN to make its oral presentation in respect of the Higher Education Amendment Bill. The Higher Education Transformation Network, Board, has 65 years of experience in higher education. As students, academics, members of the academic and executive management corps, of senates, universities, and council. And in kaleidoscope of our experiences, the one factor that has most deterred our ability to actually see change occurring in our universities has been the issue of recourse and not having insight by the minister directly. I have decided, because of time, that we should go through the slides referring to the HET and explaining what it's all about, that we could go through that fairly quickly, unless there is something specific that anybody would like to have. But I would like to look at the objectives of the HETN. So the objectives of the HETN is to lobby and provide policy advocacy for the transformation of higher education. It does program implementation, it motivates, supports and prepares students for the world of work, and it engages to enlist universities, TV colleges, feeders, host employers to empower graduates. We are, Madam Chair, pushing above our own weight. But today's presentation is done because of these specific objectives. We are concerned about the link between education and poverty eradication not being efficiently addressed. We're concerned that the National Development Plan targets are not being attained. We are concerned with the need for strong state regulation to attain higher education transformation. We're worried about the non-compliance with employment equity legislation, with poor institutional cultures, with poor state transformation in the higher education sector, with rejectionism and denialism by vice chancellors. We are concerned by the absence of female South African professoriates, in particular our black female academics. We are also worried about the privatization of university reserves, and we will show this through our presentation. In the Constitution, it says that all citizens need equal access to education, and the White Paper of 2007 says that all existing practices, institutions and values are viewed as new and they ought to be rethought in terms of fitness for the new area. The equity of access to all who seek to attain potential is important. We need to meet the national development goals, including meeting global economic needs. There's a contribution to the advancement of all forms of knowledge and scholarship which upholds academic quality, which is one of the underpinning concerns for us when it comes to transformation being a legislative imperative. And in this, we support a democratic ethos and common commitment to human development in a non-racist, non-sexist, and we speak of all nons when it comes to discrimination, and we stand against a notion of it being called wrongdoing or unfair behavior, etc., because discrimination is an imperative that we must stand up for. There are, because I'm an academic, and HCTA is an academic, an organization of alumni, we're looking specifically at how we have been explained as what education has as a role. And it says higher education is correlated with better employment outcomes and greater labor market participation. It takes a completed university degree to mostly escape unemployment in South Africa today. We also know that country with tertiary education for dependents is the responsibility of parents as opposed to state. Parental incomes affect human capital acquisition of dependents. Children of peers who cannot afford quality tertiary education are most likely not to send their offspring to tertiary education, leading to lower future. They are most likely to not send their offspring to tertiary education, which leads to low future earning potential for such offspring. Thank you, that's called collaboration, cooperation. So, the National Development Plan for 2030 says education is very critical to eliminate poverty and social inequality. The higher education avenue for social mobility strengthens equity and social justice, and the objective is to expand the production of highly skilled professionals and enhance the innovative capacity of the nation. Women and Africans who form 50% of academic and research staff. We, I think, are all familiar with the development plan vision, so I won't labour that point. But we do need a strong state regulatory intervention as far as HET is concerned. Firstly, there is largely, in our experience, a tightly wall to support government by higher education managers. We also feel that there has been negligible progress attained in reaching the targets set by the NDP to date, and we are lucky to get this to never happen if we allow the status quo to prevail. There are, across the universities and our higher education sector, transformation charges and policies in place, but the implementation is poor, and most often than not, it's their lip service by vice chancellors to their own transformation charges. The utilization of public funds is being done in a frivolous manner, in many ways. Often it's through frivolous litigation, where people are silent. Settlements are paid to people and they are made to sign documents to maintain their silence, particularly by former employees. There's less compromising of excellence and decline in managerial academic quality and standards that is used to actually resist transformation. With the non-compliance with employment equity targets actually happens by complying but purely on paper. In reality, when one goes to check the statistics, as I will show you very soon, the reality is something else, constantly. There's a lack of compliance with regards to the enforcement by the Council for Higher Education. There's an undermining, let's say, by vice-chancellors due to non-statutory advisory status of the Makoba Transformation Oversight Committee. And what I believe is being said here by HETN is that we do have serious, as was spoken about earlier, a plethora of all kinds of transformation insight and documents and semantic discussions, etc. But only certain reports and certain voices appear to be given any form of respect. So if we look at the Makoba Transformation Oversight Committee, for example, we notice that even amongst the recommendations given there, even though there are reflections between that and the prayers of the so-called Slovene Commission, there is still more respect shown for the first, and in the first and in the Slovene Commission. But action has remained absent. With Mahoba, we just see an outright pedagogical, methodological, etc. Debate. But action remains absent. Now, we have been seeing that there is a disproportionate employment of black and African academics and even the support staff as contractors, but hiring non-black white retirees as consultants. We've seen the hijacking of alumni bodies in Senate by organizations like Solidarité and AfriForum, which we are very concerned about because of the discord is causing amongst our students. We have seen, with the increasing number of CCMA cases, that more and more people are attempting to obtain justice for discriminatory workplace practices, which, of course, by and large, they cannot sustain because they do not have the money that the universities have. So we are concerned that workplace victimizations and poor career growth tends to be racialized and gendered. There are adverse organizational cultures that are at play. There are disproportionate or secretive remuneration scales being employed at universities, and there's a high turnover of black graduates and staff. So because of this, we feel that we need to actually have a look at what the statistics look like. This comes from the SGT. If we look at the workforce profile of university staff, the instruction and research staff, the administrative staff tends to be the largest group. Female particularly. It could of course be a debate for another day to actually look at which females are there and where are they positioned within those structures. If we take management staff, we see the parities, but if we look at support staff, I'd like you to know that predominantly of those 1,820 at the chief colleges even, they are predominantly black women at the lower ages of those structures. Now if we look at the universities and we look at their ranking, when it comes to the transformation of the council and senate, it provides with an interesting insight into seeing how has this actually grown across the years? How has it actually changed? Has there been any change? Chair, with your permission, I'm leaving the statistics for everybody to have a look at their leisure. But if we look at our universities today, and we look at the year that they have had to transform, we cannot ignore the fact that the University of KwaZulu-Natal, for example, has had 253 years. The University of Pretoria has 371 years. Stellenbosch has had 204 years. And yet, when we look at what happens today, the statistics remain concerning. I could go back if we need to have another look at that. So, our concern is that when we look at, because it's only because we are in Cape Town, Dr. Clark, if you'll permit me, we are looking at 382 years of change. And yet we find that the professoriate at the University of Cape Town, for example, remains negligible in relation to black women academics. So, non-compliance with employment equity, it's a common problem, says the Transudine Commission, as it's called. A common problem encountered in higher education is the lack of understanding on the part of academic and professional staff members of the importance of employment equity. ANA, the Anti-Racism Network in Higher Education, says that employment equity planning at most institutions of higher learning has become a compliance exercise to appease government with no focused discussions, no leadership, and direction in the institution. DHET says, the workforce profile of university staff indicates majority of females mostly concentrated in the administrative support staff functions, while males, mostly white males, are concentrated in the highest and upper echelon of the managerial, instructional, and research staff. Although white and black males are a minority within the higher education sector, they dominate management occupational levels in senior and top management roles, as well as professional ranks, overwhelmingly. White females still dominate the senior management roles within the sector. It would indeed say that they highlight that the continuing absence of women from what are considered traditionally masculine professions such as geology, political science, quantitative courses, hard sciences, chemistry and physics, and so forth in higher education institutions further raises questions about supposed gender parity within the sector. Now, the universities of South Africa, which Dr. Price mentioned earlier, just misses the Governor Zondo and Makhoba findings as being reductionist, essentialist, and one-dimensional. It also says that it found recommendations to be highly flawed and a much discredited assessment. In fact, Kluter writes that he equates governance after being equated equity, they have equated equity with transformation and dealing equity from development and performance. In other words, they've fell into the trap of prevailing South African condition of using transformation as a code word for race. The formula used in the paper, says Kluter, produced a result in which several of the most equitable institutions were those being run by a government-appointed administrator. It is a common South African form, its common form of accusatory politics, with the unintended consequence of the equity index of the Transformation Oversight Committee being all-focused on equity for a privileged elite. USA, the board vice chancellor, so they admire, they have constantly undermined the advisory non-statutory status of the Makhoba Oversight Committee, but they sing the praises of the Sedin Commission, despite totally ignoring it subsequently. The dereliction of duty by university council and vice chancellors require direct state intervention as far as we are concerned. Unilateral disregard for national interests and imperatives by vice chancellors and university chancellors are concerned. And in this case, I would just like to mention one. When the HET puts up this case, it does so knowing that that it is not an easy case to put forward. But 10 million rand there was in the newspaper discussed about how it was put aside by a previous vice chancellor, immediately previous, who transferred that money or donated it, the 10 million rand, to a trust without council approval and proceeded to work for the beneficiary of that 10 million afterwards. Now, no charges. We know that lawyers and legalists would like to say, yes, but no criminal charges or internal forensics found him guilty. That is irrelevant. What is relevant is that the beneficiaries of the donation of 10 million rand paid themselves 3.6 million as management fees. Now, we did find that what they did do was the council retroactively approved the entrancing of that money. The squirreling away of that money was done retroactively. It was authorized by a council retroactively. Worse yet, the chair of council has a relationship as an extra member with the FWCLAS Foundation and the director for the Center for Constitutional Rights, while the same vice chancellor was a board chairperson. So there is no guarantee that while we have the current situation of councils having fiduciary responsibility, etc., it does not mean that we can ignore what actually takes place within a council when it comes to which interests are being protected or furthered or fostered or nurtured within councils. And as an external party, it is exceptionally hard to get any insight into councils. I too am a member of a council, of a university. So if we look at the next point, which is the access of female South Africans in the professorial, I wish at the end today that we must look at the differences. When we look at the pool for full professors and associate professors, and we then look at the female full professors and associate professors, we see that female, black female professors make up only 43 of 534 across the country, full professors. In fact, I think that my colleague who did this slide probably forgot that within a black female professorship, the number of full professors is not the full 43. In fact, the 43 is made up predominantly of female associate, black female associate professors. In comparison to full professors, the numbers per se, we still see that there is almost 4 or 5 times the amount, in fact more, of black male professors. Our concern, Madam Chair, is definitely for the fact that black female professors remain absent at our universities. And we don't see how money is spent. Now, we were concerned, we've gone to the issue of looking at money and how it is spent and how it can be squirreled away. So, but let's look specifically at the issue of privatization of university reserves and flouting of the PFMA. First of all, we believe that because universities are public institutes being funded by public funds, they should be made subject to the PFMA. So if we look at the University of Cape Town, it has investments of 3.7 billion and it has 6.1 billion in reserves. My colleague here can correct me if I'm wrong. The University of Johannesburg has 10 billion. The University of Pretoria has capitalization investments of 45 billion in 2009 and reserves of 9.8 billion. The University of Stellenbosch has 7.9 billion in investments. The University of the Free State 3.3 billion total reserves. And the University of Witwatersrand at 1.7 billion in investments. And if we look at how that is possible, we have to be honest. Institutions of high learning, which were able to amass large reserves from apartheid state subsidies, need to declare these reserves back to the state for equal distribution through the national fiscus. It cannot be so that we allow the past to continue in the present by way of our finances being held captive. For example, I've worked at Northwest University, and within the confines of the university's premises, there is a house that is owned by a very senior executive member through his mother, who is now quite old. So that house is working as a guest house in bed and breakfast within the confines of the university's premises. We have to question whether that kind of privatization is or is not acceptable, and we will never be able to do it internally because you will be silenced. And that has happened to many. So if we look at this, placing a national public institution under the control of the private sector interests and diverting funds from public coffers to private company subsidiaries, whose operations, investments, accountability, director appointments and remunerations are conducted without public oversight and accountability, contravenes the PFMA and creates opportunity for rampant COVID corruption that continues with impunity. So let's look at what we're saying. The Sport Pty Limited has 100% shareholding. Enterprises at University of Pretoria has 100% shareholding. We are speaking now about private shareholding. Research Enterprises at University of Pretoria has 100% shareholding. Held Enterprises at UP, 100%. read through the entire list, but I think everybody is reading the list themselves. Continuing education, for example, what do we understand it to be? And when we actually look at the shareholding, it does call for concern. We see who the people are, and we know that it's private interest. Of course, those are not the only enterprises that can show. There are others. There's big need for greater accountability by university councils and vice chancellors. We need to remove the hidden power of USA because we do not have insight. They play guides and jury to themselves. We need to remove the passive or active resistance by higher education managers when it comes to transformation. We need an enforcement of compliance with the institutional founding statutes with the Republic of within the Constitution of the Republic. We need to enforce financial accountability and compliance with the PFMA. And the PFMA should do external audits or have it done by the Auditor General, as is the case with any other public entities of the state. The preeminence of national interest of the Republic of South Africa must be the foreground. And the attainment of the Republic's NDD Vision 2015 must be its grounding objective. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the presentation. Doctor, we will now invite the honorable members to raise clarity seeking questions. Professor Kogoli? Any other hand? Honorable Member Kassim, Honorable Member Mbaka, Honorable Member Kilia, in that order.
In your presentation, you mentioned at least two instances of what you call illegal actions. The one is Professor Kent Ehrloch and your accusations that he in some way was equally involved in Million Rand, which this committee had heard of before, which we were assured by Professor Kwadi has been sorted out. And the second one, what you call the illegal privatization of university assets. I'd like your clarification on whether this really is illegal or whether it's simply a slogan that you're using in your document, which does seem to be filled with hyperbole and accusatory language. It has lots of implications in it, things like vice chancellors are dishonest. University of South Africa is somehow an evil body with hidden powers. The whole document reads of a sort of accusatory disapproval of a sector which, from what I understand, is actually doing its best in many ways with imperfectly, as Professor van der Merwe points out, to meet many of the problems that it has. So, but my clear questions are the mention of these two illegal, what you call illegal, forms of behavior, and your hints that there are many other illegal things going on that nobody has revealed or nobody is dealing with. I do find that puzzling. I know that the sector of the Department of Higher Education and Training is very involved with universities and what they do, even if not in the kind of interfering way that the Act is now going to allow them to. And it worries me that you still perceive these so-called illegal acts, if you could just clarify.
Thank you, Nishan. Honorable Member,
thank you, Chairperson. I think before I go into my questions, I was a little bit disappointed in the submission because, as I understand it from, let me call it, preamble of the submission, the Higher Education Transformation Network agrees with the Higher Education Member Law. And then it goes into what was like an academic paper on transformation. What I would have expected in terms of the submission for an Higher Education Amendment Bill was to say, we agree with these amendments, particular disease amendments because it's necessitated by X, Y, and Z, and this is how it's going to improve the sector going forward, rather than the type of submission that we've received. But having said that, I've got two questions. The first is as it pertains to the type of public accountability that you speak about. And you had mentioned that, you know, there are councils or institutions that do not discharge their fiduciary duty in an honest manner, or in the manner in which it should be discharged. And I agree with you in some instances. There are cases of councils that do not do that. But in the current High Education Act, there are specific conditions in which intervention can take place. It's not blanket or assumed or subjective. It's conditions where intervention can take place, where a council is not discharging its governance responsibility in particular, and its fiduciary duty, as you put it, where these interventions can take place. But you then go on to say that, well, we cannot put our trust in these councils because these things do take place. What I'd like to understand, and this is where my question comes in, is how then do you justify saying, well, we should then put all of our trust centralized in the office of one person being the minister, to then be the person that we rely on to make the determination when that takes place, and to be the sort of owner of public accountability, and to look after the interests that you have referred to, and particularly with the understanding that, in fact, when you talk about public accountability, and I pick up a trend here, does not necessarily mean accountability to the minister. Because actually, we as parliament represent public, not the minister. We are the public, not the executive. And we are the representatives of the public. But I fail to understand how that would solve your problem, because it would depend who the minister is at any one particular time. The second point is, or the question is, following on from what Professor Bazzoli was asking in terms of what is phrased as illegal privatization of assets. Now, we're still a problem or a challenge in the current sector where there is a desperate need for investment in order to deal with the challenges that lay before the sector. And I'll give an example. If you look at the state of students' residences across the sector, and the inability of many institutions to have the necessary funding or to raise the necessary funding on financial markets to invest in these necessities, and the inability of the department to provide sufficient grant funding. This is just an example. We then necessitate some institutions to go and seek investment. And by definition, when you seek investment, you are also dispersing ownership, or even if it is a period of ownership in that regard. Now, I agree that there may be instances where those contracts or those investment agreements are not necessarily concluded in the public interest or in the interest of the institution per se. But surely that does not mean that you then throw the baby out of bath water and leave the challenges that exist between the sector unsolved, because there's no alternative, really. We've heard in terms of the fiscal environment that we are operating within, and if we want to improve the sector and create greater access, one does not simply then say, let's throw out any form of investment in this instance. What I would have expected, and what I perhaps suggest the Education and Transformation Network to look into, is to say, what type of mechanisms can be put in place to ensure that the public interest is looked after in this regard? And I'm sure council institutions bear responsibility in this regard, and what provisions are in place when that duty or mandate is failed by those that are charged with it. Those are my two questions, Chairperson.
Thank you for the question. Also on a procedural matter, the question should have relevance to the Higher Education Amendment Bill, and also the responses should link with the higher education amendment bill, because we are about the bill today. Thank you very much. Shall we then get... Oh, no. There's somebody else. I'm sorry. Honourable Member Mata.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to get clarity on two things. I agree with the environment that you described. I think to a greater extent it's a reflection of what we seek to have never anticipated, but it has unfortunately been trend in many instances. I have to just sit in one answer. Some of the things were real, and you could see that universities that are actually being guided by individual greed and corporate governance come in first, another excuse for people to club together for their own interests and treat determine so many things, from positions to economic opportunities. And what I've witnessed personally is also the decline of what I would call moral leadership. We tended in the past 10 years to have appointed vice chancellors on the basis of connectivity with some council members. And as such, we lost out on a number of people that have generated the kind of vice chancellor case that would have at least taken our university system forward. Now, with regard to your specific recommendation in what the Act wants to achieve, what is it that is in here that we are calling for? Because you call for an array of acknowledgements on an environmental analysis, but we need to move with speed on agreeing with the current amendments, and if they fall short, where do they fall short? Is there to be an extraordinary regime in the current amendment to jack up whatever that is transformational to add to the public good? What is it? Because it is important that when you leave here, you must get some emotional assurance that we understood exactly how you would prefer things going forward.
Thank you, Honourable Member Mata. I will now call upon Honourable Member Gillian.
Chairperson, I believe the presentation largely supported the need for intervention to ensure that transformation goals are met. But I would like to just go back to the issue of the PFMA. What would be the higher education network's position with regards to the PFMA? Because from where I understand the Act at this stage, and I'm looking at the department because we have not had a clarification, it is listed as one of the new definitions in the Act. But that does not mean that without an amendment, that an amendment to the PFMA would not be necessary. Because I know that some of the entities reporting to the department unlisted in the schedule of the Act. But universities do not count for them. So clearly that would necessitate also an amendment of the PFMA. So that's just my first point, and that's the understanding of the higher education network as well. Secondly, if the large scale corruption is taking place at universities, what is it that prohibits people from using current legislation, particularly the Act with the very long name, the Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities Act 12 of 2004. If evidence exists, if it is there, why have no institution so far made the effort to in fact lay a charge and bring those to book so that they could in fact account for the alleged corrupt activities? So I just wanted to ask that. I am concerned that we are dealing here with details of the Act. We must make sure that that we also consider other pieces of legislation and how this act would impact on other pieces of legislation, or you know, how it is probably covered in other pieces of legislation. But you need to know exactly where it would be necessary to intervene and tighten some of the gaps to ensure accountability on the part of the whole sector. I think that is our aim. Thank you very much.
Thank you for all the questions. And I'll cross over to you, Doctor, to bring clarity to those issues that have been raised.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Firstly, I would really appreciate it if we look back at my presentation at some point and check that I actually said at some stage that people have behaved illegally. What I have done is to lay before you examples of what we find very questionable behavior, which is why we specifically said in relation to Dr. Chien's law that despite the fact that no external charges were laid, and despite the fact that a forensic examination was done internally, he was not held accountable. He was not found guilty. Yet, after that date, counsel met to retroactively sanction what had already been done. So, if there was no concern about whether or not it was correct and acceptable behavior, why would counsel then have to meet and do so retroactively? So we are not saying he should be locked up because he's guilty. We are saying that when this kind of discrepancy does occur, there is no person, despite what might be in the statute, Member Killian, despite what's in the statute, a member of the public is not going to know what has occurred or what the extent of the actions are solely because the decision was made in council. Council minutes are not readily made available to the public. And I suppose AGTN being really probably the little sister in this auspicious space today, since we are surrounded by so many of our big brothers, we don't keep at the same level, at the same height, or at the same weight as everybody else. So we thank you, Member Carter, for your insight on what we might possibly want to look at. I'd like to say that our written submission has probably got more of what you are calling for than what we actually did as our oral presentation, because we expected that would be read and dealt with accordingly. As far as we are concerned, when it comes to the notion that there is a rampant corruption across the entire country and all the universities, etc., it is certainly not HEC's intention to create a paranoia. What it does want to do is to create concern, simply because insight is so limited. You can imagine that when you are drowning, even if somebody does throw you just half of a life raft, you go for it. And that's how this looks. This is what the amendment bill looks like to us. We finally see a possibility that we will have recourse, that we can actually have a voice. We've not been able to have our voice protected. HETN has been taking universities to court. We have tried to use the means at our disposal, and we work predominantly with pro bono lawyers. So when we feel that an action has been illegal, we do indeed use both internal and external means to address those. As far as PSMA is concerned, we agree, because higher education institutions are not in the PSMA, this of course is a club trying to get it in there. Maybe not as sophisticated as we could have done, but this is what we have to put on the table, because we are also the people. Comrade Bata, I'm not sure that I quite understood what you were asking me to do, other than to reiterate really loudly that we definitely, definitely are in support of the amendment bill as it is. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your clarity. We will then move on to the next presentation. Maybe I should indicate that tea is served at the back. Now, I think you should feel free to help yourself without us interrupting this flow of presentations. So, please feel free to help yourself. We will now move over to the next presentation, which is a presentation by CHE. Thank you very much for the engagement on the presentation by HETN.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. We appreciate the opportunity as CHE to also present how we see the provisions of the amendment, higher education amendment bill. As you are aware, the central to our mandate as a Council on Higher Education is quality assurance and promotion. And there are many other things that the F has given us a mandate to. But if I put it differently, what is really important in our job is that when qualifications are issued, it should be qualifications that are credible and that are worth the paper that they are written on. And therefore, it is very important that if there are any disruptions or poor management or weak governance in all of these institutions, quality obviously suffers for the provision, and that becomes a threat to our system, and of course the employability of the graduates. We have submitted our paper. It is available, and the introductory part is fairly straightforward, which is what the portfolio committee knows about our role to advise the minister and perform quality assurance activities. And when we look at the overview, of course we are aware that there are many contestations to the bill. It has been since 2012 when it was issued in its first version. And at the moment we are satisfied that the provisions that speak to the promotion of access to information and of course promotion of administrative justice act have been taken care of in order to actually align the act with those pieces of legislation. And of course there has been inconsistencies and contradictions, and we also agree that this act is attempting to do that. And of course these amendments that we have here, we believe are intended to illuminate and clarify some of the matters pertaining to the much spoken about institutional autonomy and public accountability, and to understand corporate governance as we had it in the white paper 3. And of course, part of the overview has to deal with the consultation between what we believe could be regularized between the National Qualifications Framework Act and Higher Education Act, and we are actually satisfied that this amendment bill actually has repealed Section 70 of the Higher Education Act, which of course made it problematic that it was the supremacy of the Act over any other law, whereas the NQA Act was saying the same thing about certain sections of it. So that has been removed, and we are happy with that. But we'll get back to this point as it pertains to Section 34 of the National Qualifications Framework Act. And having said that, Chairperson, we also note that given the amendment that we have, there has been iterations about do we really define transformation and how do we define it, and so on and so forth. And we believe that the White Paper 3 was quite extensive on the parameters within which transmission should be looked into by the sector. And the amendment that we welcome, as it is in our papers, is that intention and the spirit is fairly well understood. And of course, the issues around transformation goals that are supposed to be set, we understand it to be a matter that is still requiring further engagement in terms of how these are set for the system and so on and so forth. But on the other hand, I mean, we know that there are continued perceptions about lack of transformation across the sector. And of course, the reality is that the sector continues to require transformation. It doesn't really matter to us which type of an institution it is. We know that this country is transforming, and so our institutions. And of course, we have, in many instances, a litany of protest across institutions and the cry for transformation. And therefore, we cannot ignore that. It's just a matter of if these goals are set, we are saying it is very critical that the methodology that will be adopted in exercising this oversight role should be consistent and transparent to all parties. In other words, goals cannot be set in such a way that they did not get the input of other relevant stakeholders. And of course, as matters stand, as you know, the CAG has a particular role to play in terms of this, and we also know that the Minister also put together a transformation oversight committee, and as the CAG we put this before the Minister in our meeting, that we believe that this could confuse sectors, should look into it. Having said that, Jefferson, the second point that we acknowledge with the amendment, of course, has to do with the ministerial directive, independent assessors and administrators. We know that the current legislation has had certain shortcomings, and we understand this to be strengthening the role of institutions in terms of public accountability and good governance, and without really interfering with the autonomy and academic freedom of institutions of higher learning. Good governance is quite essential in how these institutions are run, and we have experienced many instances of dysfunctional institutions in the country. The critical question for us is that if these other institutions are very well managed and well governed, and others have got these many dysfunctionalities, can you really legislate differently? You cannot have a different set of legislation for one set of institutions that are doing well and others that are not doing well. It has to cut across the board. And of course, there has to be checks and balances with that type of legislation that is put. As it is the case here, we know that as far as we are concerned, we do not believe that there is a conflict between academic freedom and the independence of institutions to conduct their core business, which is to teach and research. And of course, that as far as the public accountability goes, it is of course because if we speak of public institutions, they are of course required to account for the resources that are being allocated by this house to them. So the CAG believes that the interventions that are put across are intended to challenge poor governance, the slow pace of transformation, and of course to make accountability measures that we have in the system. It is in fact true that the transformation is fairly slow in some instances, and this cuts across all institutions regardless of their history. The third one that we welcome has to do with the private higher education institutions and the fact that if these institutions fulfill the necessary requirements, could be accorded status of a university. We know that is not the case at the moment, and we believe that it's unconstitutional. But if they are able to meet all the requirements, of course that could be looked into with a sense of rules that will be put in place to make them to be accorded as leaders. And of course we believe this will dispel the perception that these institutions offer low quality education. It is not necessarily true, because at the CHE, you know, Chairperson, that we accredit all of these institutions that are offering here, and that is a very, very rigorous process. So it doesn't really therefore follow that if you are a private institution, your quality is necessarily low. So we also further believe that if there is a very healthy collaborations and competition in the sector, this will assist us to improve quality of provision. And the fourth one, Chair, that we support has to do with the withdrawal and revocation of degrees, diplomas and certificates in case they were awarded fraudulently. And I think we will revert back to this point when we deal with the concerns that we have about the bill, because as it stands, we believe that it can be improved, because there are many, many difficult bases that we come across at the institutional level with these kinds of things. Nevertheless, we support the point that if the qualification has been fraudulently awarded, or erroneously, it needs to be withdrawn. And the last point under the positives has to do with the procedures that independent assessors have to follow in conducting investigations. And I think this is a much better configuration of this compared to how it has been. It is quite an improvement, because I remember the past when we were involved in this, there were a number of restrictions, so there is indemnification clauses and all of that, but at least that these investigations should be done within the stipulations of the law and taking into account all the other substantive legislation that we have. I will further go on to deal with the concerns that we have, and later the questions, of course, that we'll deal with as a team. The first concern, Chairperson, that we have has to do with the NQF Act and the Higher Education Act, what we believe confuses matters. We understand the intention and the spirit of the Act as it stands, but in Section 2, about the supremacy of the Act, in terms of Section 34 of the National Qualification Act, this may have implications for the identity and the mandate of the CHE, as well as on the impact of its work on the national education system. It could be different understandings of it, and we believe that we should make certain that the provisions of the NQF Act and that of the Act are not in such a way that they dilute what is intended of our independent efforts at the role of the CHE, because we would very much like to keep the independence in our advice. And the second part is still flowing from the NQF Act and the Higher Education Act, this particular amendment bill, is about the way in which this appears to be subordinate to the NQF Act. And we know that in the Transformation Summit that was just around the Christmas fall period, we don't have contradictions and gaps and so on and so forth. And we believe that this should also be one of those, but we understand that it will take some time for us to get there. But between the work that is ongoing with the NPF Act, which appears to, at some other point, that it will be amended to some extent, we believe that we shouldn't build contradictions into it. We understand our mandate as a CHE as far as the Act is concerned, as far as the NPF Act is concerned, that it would be seamless if we don't create perceptions that will keep us immediately busy, particularly in court. And the third concern that we have has to do with Section 31, 13(1)(h)(3), the skill. This has to do with, I think Dr. Pryor mentioned it in his presentation, but our angle on this particular one has to do with what we believe is the confusion that arises between what the South African Qualifications Authority is a possibility in terms of credit accumulation and assessment violating myself. So we believe that this particular aspect of the work should be left with the SACO instead of the minister now coming in to take the responsibility for all of these other aspects, articulation and so on and so forth. It is, of course, confusing, and we believe that SACO is better place to do that, and if there are any other concerns, they should be addressed in a way that we don't create confusion, because otherwise this is duplication of services and a waste of resources. And the fourth one, Chairperson, that we have a concern about, it has to do with the Senate. If, as it is proposed in the Act, that the private higher education institutions could register as universities, obviously, as part of the requirements, universities basically to teach and research, and we believe that this should therefore be regularized, and as it stands, we can only make the assumption that this will be built into subordinate legislation or rules or regulations that may come up. But we are concerned that this amendment would stipulate that the private higher education institutions would be required to have the appropriate structure, such as the Senate, to actually oversee the quality arrangement for the institutions, and of course conduct research, because there are many private universities, as you know, across the world, who do what we do as publics, or do even better. The fifth concern, Chairperson, that we have about the bill is on the withdrawal and revocation of qualification. Excuse me, I said to revert back to this particular one. We don't believe that people should attain this qualification fraudulently, and the Act is actually trying to ameliorate that problem. But the concerns that we have are twofold. It doesn't appear that this takes care of private higher education institutions as well, because we believe that it's not only at public higher education institutions where there would be fraudulent and of course erroneous qualifications that are issued. It should also take care of private higher education institutions, because they do the same that we do in the public and social space. And the second concern that we have is the time allocated for this withdrawal or revocation of qualifications being a period of 2 years. And we believe that 2 years is not sufficient to do this. I don't even want to go into practical examples, Chairperson. In my previous life as a registrar of a university, many cases of plagiarism, people leave the country and they go elsewhere. You get after 10 years or 5 years, universities that will remain nameless of people that have actually left institutions with certificates that are fraudulent and are being, you know, uncovered later. If 2 years lapses, then you don't have a case and people are running around with qualifications that are not where they pay for the ultimate one. So we believe that is quite serious. So the issue, therefore, edges that this House rethink this time frame of 2 years. It is too short. And the sixth point is a fairly straightforward one. I don't want to even get into that one. It's just, I think, an error in the document. And the act, of course, in the bill, center around all the issues that we have, plus the white paper. And we support it as a Fiji, but to the main concern that there are two other areas that are being conflated here. If you look at the post-school education and training system, and what we have, and we believe that perhaps we should focus on higher education. But of course we're open to persuasion, they're not too strong. And lastly, the amendment in the private higher education, education students chapter will no doubt of course necessitate a further amendment in the rules and regulations and so forth. We take note of that. And Chairperson, we believe that this piece of legislation as it stands has been a subject of consultation. We know what has happened since 2012, and we believe that we've made progress. And we'd like to thank this committee for affording us the opportunity to make this submission. We would have preferred to have, as it was the case in the past, advised the minister earlier on this. You and also and I can agree on that, but it's okay. It's beside the point. And of course, our contribution, I must say, finally, is underpinned our focus on the quality of provisioning in the system for both private and public institutions. And of course, we're doing the research where we can do, but of course, NRF has put a wider mandate on that. And we're concerned about governance in public higher education. We're concerned about transformation of the curriculum and all of the issues. And we believe that we can make a positive contribution. And thank you very much. We'll be able to respond to current seeking questions. And I think all the detailed questions will be answered by the CEO.
All right, thank you so much. Professor Musia for the presentation. I was looking at the next presentation, it's only one page. Now I want to consult with honorable members if we could allow this presentation also to go and then have or entertain clarity seeking questions after the second presentation. Agree? Agreed. Shall we then have CIE, which is Catholic Institute of Education, to present to this meeting on the higher education in the world.
Thank you, Chair.
Are you ready, sir?
I'm ready, thank you.
Thank you very much. Over to you.
Good afternoon, Chair. Good afternoon, members of the committee and ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for allowing us just to make some brief points. Most of our concerns were covered by other members as well. And as you said, it's just one page, so I won't keep you up too long. Just in general, we support most of the range of proposed amendments. And we would like just to commend the department as well for your, you know, for the amount of work they put into drafting the bill. In particular, we are very supportive of the provision of clauses 30 to 33 that will allow private institutions the core universities. As you may know or may not know, the Catholic Church owns St. Augustine, this country called Pali South Africa, and we would like to change that to be called the university. So thank you for making that particular proposal. And just in terms of some of the concerns that we have, it has been raised before, and I think our major concern is that we don't have an issue with the transformation goals. I think what is problematic is that it's not clearly defined. And we also think that there needs to be a fine balance stuck between those transformation goals and also, you know, be careful not to encroach upon the institutional autonomy as well. And then just lastly, the whole proposes some expansion on some of the powers of the minister. Some of them already exist in the Act, others don't. But we would just like to point out that the extent to which these powers impact on the institutional autonomy and academic freedom of public and state liberties will require careful scrutiny and monitoring. I think some of those issues have already been highlighted by some of the other the other inputs as well. So yeah, thank you, Chair, for allowing us just this brief input.
Thank you so much for also showing interest in this bill and also making your input on the bill. Honourable members, I will now invite for clarity seeking questions. Professor Pozzoli, Honourable Member Kilian, Honourable Member Mtunu, Honourable Member Mbata. Am I seeing correctly? Is your hand up? Oh, right. Honourable Member Keka, over to you, folks.
Thank you. First of all, just a comment. It's a very serious omission that the Minister has not consulted with CHE before this bill was put forward. I understand, in fact, during the formulation of the bill, it seems as though CHE's consultative aspect is being completely silent. And I think in your comments later you emphasised that by talking about how there's a contradiction between the NQF Act and SACWA, and you're worried about that contradiction not being properly resolved. I want to ask you a couple of questions. Firstly, have you at any point taken into account the risks pointed out by a couple of the other presenters, I think three or four of them, inherent in the idea of ministerial intervention, inherent in the assumption that ministers are always benevolent, inherent in the modification of the directive capacity of the minister and of the setting of a transformation goals by the minister, which are then monitored by an unspecified body. If you haven't taken these into account, would you consider taking them into account? Secondly, what do you think of the idea that the CHE should act as a vehicle for ministerial transformation initiatives and oversight in order for a buffer body to be put into place which protect institutions from ministerial folly? On your point about contradictions between all the various acts that govern higher education, are you serious about the idea of a super act? Because that does seem to be an impossibility. And would you consider rather maybe a study which looks at contradictions between the various acts and deal with them one by one? And lastly, thank you for pointing out the NQF Act and SACWA contradictions. I think that's something that hasn't been raised before, and I think that's something we need to look at. And thank you also for pointing out the fact that this Act, this bill now moves into the field of post-school education when it's meant to be a higher education bill. And again, thank you for that. That's something we need to look at. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Honourable Member Kilian,
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, I wanted clarification from the DHD with regards to its view. Now, there is one paragraph that's lost in its submission, which refers to the white paper and the university sector, and then the expansion of the higher education in Mainland School to also make reference to the college sector. And that it is a view of the CHE that the two should not be conflated. Now, could you, from the white paper, would you see that it would be necessary to reconfigure the mandate of the Council for Higher Education? Also to perhaps strengthen its role? And would you agree that some of the concerns raised by some of the other presenters with regards to directors, that the CHE could actually fulfill a very important role to, before matters go to the minister, the CHE actually expresses itself on some of the institutional concerns raised by universities if they are queried by the minister? Would you see that there's an expanded role? It is indeed good, as Honourable Bazzoli has indicated, that you have highlighted the NQFA Act and the fact that that Act takes precedence if there is any uncertainty in terms of that Act. Section 34, I believe. How would you see us amend the draft bill or draft act before the committee at present, to make provisions to make sure that there is no ambiguity about the role of the CHE, that we separate issues where they should be separated, or do you think the bill needs a new name because it is now referring to much more than only universities and higher education as such, but also encompasses other elements of the both school sector? Then lastly, Chairperson, I just want to say that I also voted the concern about the private institutions, private universities, and I thought that that is probably a matter that we need to also look at. I see the Honourable Farrow is shaking his head. I believe that we had a discussion about the matter, but we will have to look at that. And then clearly it is quite serious, your 4.6, that was omitted. We should also correct reference to the HEQSF at present. Thank you very much, Jefferson.
Thank you, Honourable Member Chile. Honourable Member Mkhulu.
Thank you, Jefferson. Let me welcome the submission by CHE on your concerns regarding the withdrawal and revocation of degrees, diplomas, certificates, and other applications. You feel that the window of 2 years is too short for the qualifications conferment processes. What realistic time frames would you recommend for this process as an amendment? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Member Mkhulu. Honourable Member Kirana.
Thanks, Chair. Mkhulu took my question or story, but just to motivate that, I'm sure that 2 years was back to President Liu to remember somebody has a frozen certificate and it takes too long. Say, like you quoted that 10 minutes because of the overseas. The damage that could accrue out of that certificate in those, if it is medicine, I can't imagine how many patients it treated with the fraudulent statement, certificate. And don't you think we still have to retain the limited possible time so that you work hard at it and in the soonest possible time you get a better conclusion? But I'm also interested to hear what you think is reasonable. You don't want somebody to work with a fraudulent statement, and when he goes to pension, it's only then that you stop the certificate because you've given a long, long time for the investigation.
Thank you very much. I'll now cross over to the presenters to respond to those questions that have relevance to the bill.
Very much, Honourable Chair. I will now delegate my duties to the members of the panel, but I will take Honourable Pozzoli's questions first, particularly to and thank you very much for the welcoming of some of the comments and the observations that you had. But speaking to the risks that you have identified with respect to ministerial interventions and so on and so forth. We actually looked into these provisions quite meticulously. And flowing from the spirit of the Constitution about corporate governance and that we need to trust one another and do things in a way that is good for the country and the system and so forth. And of course, we are acutely aware that there are instances where power corrupts, as it is said. And of course, the directives in our understanding or interventions that are set by the minister were necessitated by what we described as dysfunctional institutions for whatever reason. And which is why I made a comment that it becomes very difficult to legislate differently for different types of institutions or circumstances at these institutions. And yes, we have engaged with it. And we knew that this remains a sore point. In certain sectors of the system, but also other sectors that actually welcome it. Now, as a CAG, we welcome that there should be an intervention, but that intervention shouldn't just happen in a draconian manner or a vindictive manner or that type of thing. There should be checks and balances, which I believe this House can be able to put it in place. The CAG, we have a particular mandate and we are an independent statutory body and we endeavor by any means necessary to remain independent and therefore to be a vehicle that could be able to assist before we get to even the stage where directives are issued. Who would welcome that as the Council on Higher Education? Because our duty is to advise the minister. We could perhaps advise the minister, yes, you need to issue the directive. Or, no, we believe you should issue the directive, rather let us help this man and this and the other way, and so on and so forth. So, there should be that kind of a process that assists us to move forward. And yes, we would, of course, welcome attention to contradictions in various pieces of legislation, not necessarily the Super Act, because that has got its own shortcomings as well. But if there are contradictions, because we are in a very litigious environment at the CAG, we would not be able to do certain things, because people take us all over the show with different pieces of legislation. And I'll give the other questions to the other members of the panel, starting with Honorable Kieran's questions.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll address three of the issues that have arisen. I'm Narayan Vaishnav, the CEO. The first relates to the question by Honorable Member Bozzoli. And the CHE is a vehicle or a upper body and providing oversight and transformation issues. I think that the chairperson has addressed the issue partially. We, I think, are open to playing any constructive role in the sector, particularly where there might be contentious or controversial issues. Because where there's a diversity of views and perspectives on particular matters, the CHE can play a very effective role in mediating these views and intervening in a constructive way to take matters to resolution. Otherwise, we can have protracted debates and protracted contestation, which is often not held before the sector. So we express a view on matters upon invitation or upon our own initiative as we see fit from time to time. And if we see that matters are affecting the sector of particular contentiousness, then nothing stops us from expressing a view and providing advice to the minister on this. So either we are invited by the minister or we do so for our own volition. That avenue exists at the moment, and we do that quite regularly. So even on this matter, if it's an issue that's contentious, we will certainly not shy away from our duty in terms of the mandate of the DHE. The second issue, in terms of the proposal, and I take the point made by Professor Bazzoli that maybe a super act may not be too practical, but indeed it will be a useful exercise that we, on the short term, for us to look at the contradictions, because certainly it has come to our attention, and in preparing for this particular submission, some of these were apparent that we've made part of our submission. But it will be a very useful exercise to mobilize a group of experts, and particularly legal experts, who can bring these under proper scrutiny and then make proposals on how the alignment and articulation can happen. What we are mindful of is that the Higher Education Act in its first iteration, and of course there were subsequent amendments along the years, that it was a mirror to the policy at the time of the White Paper 3 in 1997. Now, and that was focused primarily on higher education. The situation now is that the 2013 White Paper is for post-school education, or post-school education to include higher education. So I think we should look critically at whether the amended act as we have it now is sufficiently attentive to all of the consideration with this new white paper, which is focused on post-school education. We've given attention to it, I must say, from the perspective primarily of the higher education sector and the provisions for higher education. And I don't believe we've applied our mind sufficiently to the other elements, and perhaps we should going forward. But this is something we take note of and think that deserves some attention. And then on the question of my honourable member Bruno about on the realistic time frame for the window of 2 years. My view would be, and I'm sure that my colleague might have other views, that if a qualification is fraudulent, it's fraudulent. So it may come to light after 2 years, it may come to light after 10 years, or 20 years, or even 30 years. So it does not mean that if you have been able to complete it for an appreciable period of time, that you should be able to get away with it. Fraud is fraud, no matter when it comes to light. And I think we should leave the door open. And in fact, I would personally be opposed to a time, some kind of time period being imposed, that when fraud comes to light, it should be investigated, and if it's found to, if the qualification is found to have been fraudulent, you should withdraw. Simple as that. So we shouldn't constrain ourselves so that those who have been lucky to get away with it can keep the qualification, and those that haven't been
lose their qualifications. That is my view on it, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you. Was
there, okay, so there's another one, okay, please,
may come in and proceed.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm John, I'm a member of the CHC, I'm the Chair of Tire Education Quality Committee, I'm a member of this team. I thought I would add my voice to the last point that has been made by the CEO regarding the time frame for withdrawal of the degree or the qualification. And with respect to the question raised by Honourable Tuno and Honourable Kekana. The first point I wanted to make was that our concern actually deals with two issues. The fact that this obligation is only confined to public higher education institutions and not private higher education institutions. And of course the second concern is the two-year time frame. I'm happy to note that we are all agreed on at least the fact that this amendment is necessary. We also agreed on the process, and I think the question is only related to the time frame in terms of 2 years. We should also note, by the way, that the withdrawal may be as a result of the error on the part of the higher education institution, also maybe as a result of fraudulent or dishonest act on the part of the candidate, and that's very important. But having the stipulation of 2 years, I think the CEO made the point quite clear. See, a fraudulent degree is a fraudulent degree. Time does not make it mature into a legal degree. So, if you put a period of 2 years, the assumption is that regardless of the error, however material, after 2 years, it becomes a legitimate degree. And I think that is problematic situation. Fraud is fraud. So, I think our collective thinking is that it should actually be timely. Whenever, at whatever point it is discovered to have been fraudulently obtained or erroneously obtained, it should be withdrawn. Because there is nothing that will rectify the error. Time will not rectify the error. So that is, I think, our thinking, and just putting 2 years. And I'm doing this, by the way, from the fact that my institution has come out of a situation where the Supreme Court actually ruled against us with respect to the fact that we should not have withdrawn a student's degree. And one of the reasons, of course, was that there was no stipulation in the legislation that provided for that, and there was that issue also of time frame. So the legislation that is clear on the limitlessness of the time will be the advantage of the higher education sector. Thank you.
Thank you for the clarity that you have brought to members. I just want to check with looking for your name, okay, Mr. Hassan. Do you have any the clarity that you'd like to bring with regards to your submission?
I don't think so, Chair. No questions for Derek. I think he was so short and sweet, and it was clear.
All right, thank you very much. I see members still want to have a second bite on this, so I will allow the Honourable Member, Mrs. Keelan, and then Honourable Member Ketan. Thank you, Chairperson. Can the CHD please explain if they share concerns by some institutions during their presentations this morning about the institutional autonomy and academic freedom that will be infringed upon by some of the provisions of the amendment bill? For instance,
the reference to transformational goals and oversight mechanisms, etc. Can you please explain to us, is there a common understanding of what constitutes academic freedom and what constitutes institutional autonomy within the public higher education sector? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Honourable Member, get
on. On the 2 years ago, would you rather have the act saying 2 years or minimum 2 years if it be an extension of 2 years? I'm just afraid to leave it unlimited, knowing that dealing with the issues of certificates, SMC takes forever. We're still waiting for the outstanding certificate to be issued. And our institutions seem to really battle with this threat of certificates and would like it to extend itself forever. Because remember the data, if it is engineering, how many products will come, factory floors, if it is medicine, how much data it is to patients who are treated by a person who is not qualified. And it goes on and on. So would you rather have 2 years, but it may be an extension given, rather than just an unlimited thing. You don't, institutions like I'm saying, don't have a good history of dealing with certificates. And if they are not concerned, I'm afraid to do go forever.
Thank you. Honorable Pakistan, your last opportunity to respond on those last seeking questions.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. I will officially, with your permission, attempt to respond to the first set of questions that Honorable Killian put across. I see my team inadvertently omitted them. And this has to do with the expanded role of the CAG. And secondly, will be the set of questions that you put across here, which of course have to do with directives as well. The way we understand our role at the CAG is that given the new developments that we have, particularly with the white paper on post-school education and training, is that we actually have a role to play as well. Because this is the entire system. And if it is possible for the role of the AG to be strengthened and or expanded, we would be able to step up to challenge. Because I think to duplicate many structures to do the same thing is not very cost-effective for the country. All that would have to be done is just to reconfigure the CAG itself and resource it appropriately and be able to do this kind of work rather than to duplicate structures. And of course, with respect to other input made by the sector, when we look at the amendment bill, particularly with respect to academic freedom and institutional autonomy, We don't see that this is a threat to that. All that we see is inputs that are anticipating what could be problematic in the future. And then, of course, depending on which type of minister you have and so forth. And therefore, it becomes very difficult for us to be speculative on that. Because our understanding is that the public accountability aspect is what appears to be put across as prominent, and then there are threats linked to that being institutions of academic freedom may be curtailed. And I don't see that happening in the sense that unless the constitution is amended with respect to academic freedom, because it's there, it's enshrined, universities will continue to teach and research in the manner that has been the case. The issue about the institutional autonomy, which is of course not that prescribed in the Constitution, is where the contestation lies, that as institutions of higher learning, a number of things have been happening over a long period of time, rightly or wrongly. And so we just see that perhaps the fear of the unknown, if I may put it that way. And I believe this House would not have any intention to pass a law that would be draconian and take us to the past and give unfettered powers where you're not supposed to do that. And I believe that even the minister will be able to be sanctioned by Parliament on some of the things if they are out of line. But issue of that is, as I said, we would be able, if it is so legislated as a PhD, to act in between there to ensure that we don't have a collapse of the system before this happens. As you know, one of our mandate is to actually audit these institutions. We've spoken about this in this house for a while. To actually detect much earlier where the problems are, to avoid these kind of things. And where it's any fraud and people are corrupt and to do all sorts of things, and of course the law will have to take its course there. But the threat to academic freedom, we don't see. And to institutional autonomy, institutions will remain. It's just that I think what we hear is that there's just no too many reporting requirements that are required of institutions of higher learning. And the reporting is required by this Parliament. We need to account for the resources that we get. So how frequently you do it, for me, it's neither here nor there. Or the CAG, because I mean it's public resources that we are using. I think these are the comments that we have regarding academic freedom. And the transformation goes. Yes, it is true that we don't have a definition in the Act or in the Bill. But it is also true that with the many iterations that we had on transformation, particularly starting with the White Paper 3, which actually outlined how transformation parameters are set. We can take that as a basis. But because there are emotional issues related to transformation, we are where we are now, and our objectivity becomes tainted in trying to do the right thing for the country as a whole. And sometimes it could even be individualized or institutionalized because the institution X doesn't want to do this or wants to do things in another way. The CAG, we believe that the oversight role of this House, you have to be very wise to actually come to some way of moving through on this particular. Thank you very much.
With your permission, Chair, I just wanted to respond to Honorable Khan's question. Let me make two or three points. The first point is that the difference between a degree and a certificate. Certificate is the take on which symbolizes the degree, and the degree is the status. So when you withdraw the status, whether the person has even received the certificate or not. The second point is that I can understand Honorable Khan's concern. It's really about fairness and reasonableness in the way that may affect the candidate whose degree is being withdrawn. But remember, as lawyers say, it was void at the initial. It shouldn't have been. So you can't talk about reasonableness and fairness when the person should have voted to be in the first place. Now, the third point is that, you know, it actually takes time to discover fraud in a degree or in a certificate. I'll give an example. Suppose the fault is plagiarism. Now, it will take time to discover the plagiarism. This is what universities do. They digitize the cases. That means they put them online. That is a process that takes about a year or two to have them full digitized. And before people out there read them online or have any opportunity to
make reference to them, it is 3, 4, or 5 years down the line. Usually, it is the person whose work is being plagiarized that discovers it, and that would be about 3, 4, 5 years down the line. So, if you have only 2 years, that means that after 2 years, the person got away with it. Anyway, in conclusion, this house may well feel that giving it a limitless period is stretching it. But we are saying 2 years is too short a period. I was interested in the example that the Honorable Kekana gave about the doctor and the media. I mean, if the doctor, because of a fake degree, has been actually killing people in the theater, and you say, now, he's been doing this for a long time, now it can go on, there's no problem. By saying, now, you can continue with your degree, I guess that's what we are trying to avoid. There's, you know, the longer the period that does not justify or make it more authentic. And that's the point we're trying to make. Thank you, Jess.
Your last one.
Yes. I would like to add a perspective to that shared by the chairperson on the issue of institutional autonomy and academic freedom. We are very mindful of the sensitivities around this. And I think that some members may be familiar with a major publication by the Council on Higher Education on the matter of academic freedom, where the debate was aired and several perspectives were shared, which were deeply philosophical in nature, and reaffirmed the imperative to preserve academic freedom as value that's enshrined in the Constitution as well. I think that as far as institutional autonomy is concerned, and the questions that have arisen, especially with the other presentation, the consideration has to be what the intent behind it is. Is it an intent to erode the independence or the autonomy of institutions? Our view there is that it is not. It's actually, it could be, there are two possibilities with these particular provisions in the amendment. So it could be to erode the institutional autonomy, but could be an enabling instrument to intervene where it is necessary. Our own reading of it is that where we've had this functionality in institutions that have been mismanaged, where there's been corruption, or where there's been complicity or collusion between management and council members and so on, to the detriment of students, to the detriment of alumni, ultimately to the public interest. It has been, because of the convolutions and the restrictions of the current provision, it's very difficult to make any intervention. You can see it and you have to stand aside helplessly, not able to do something. But by the time you can actually intervene, the damage is so serious that it's difficult to pull it back. So we see it as an enabling instrument for intervention much more decisively, far more quickly, to deal with malaise in an institution. We don't see it as an intention or the motivation really to erode the institutional autonomy of institutions. Given the appeals we've got at the sectoral level, we've seen the need for intervention in several institutions. And that's how we read this particular provision, Jefferson. Thank you.
I know we have time constraints. The time now is 1:30. We have to join the parliamentary session after this, too. And we shouldn't be late for that time. But thank you very much. Sorry for cutting some of the questions, but I am about to round up this engagement. I just want to find out from the department if they would like to say something. Because the department is here also to observe and listen to oral submissions by the key stakeholders. Anything from the department? None. Mr. Patel?
Thank you, Chairperson. I think both the portfolio committee and the organizations providing submissions must please look at the clause in regard to the revoking qualification. The 2 year time limit is only on the public institutions that themselves have made an error. So the 2 years is a statute of limitations. The next section D is about a fraudulent. There's no time limit in regards to the fraudulent qualification.
We take note of the point that you have raised, and thank you very much. It does look like we've come to the end of our engagement, but then as we round up, I'd like to thank the Department of Higher Education and Training for being with us here and also listening to all the submissions with regard to the Higher Education Amendment Bill. I'd also like to thank members for their meaningful and relevant questions that they raised, clarity-seeking questions that they raised. I strongly believe that we now have gained deeper insight on the issues that have been submitted to this meeting. I'd also like to thank all the stakeholders for acceding to the call by this committee for written submissions on the Higher Education Amendment Bill, B36 of 2015. Indeed, I would like to also thank you for your time to come before the committee to make your oral submissions, and also for bringing clarity on those matters that needed further explanation on your submission. We have listened to your submissions, and we have made the following observations: that there are common areas of concern raised by the stakeholders, and also we pick up positive comments on other sessions. Now the department and the state law advisors and parliament legal advisor have also listened and will respond to submissions next week in our meeting with them, whereby we will be looking at the submissions that you have made and then deliberating on those submissions. As I have indicated earlier on in my opening remarks, the process is continuing tomorrow at 9:30. The committee will be receiving more oral submissions from more key stakeholders. On conclusion of the oral submission, the committee will meet with the department and then deliberate on these matters. Once more, we'd like to thank you for participating in this law-making process. And in line with the open democracy, you are invited to attend our meetings to follow on the further developments and the progress made in this law-making process. Thanks for your meaningful contribution. The meeting between ourselves is adjourned. I just have remarks for the honourable members. Honourable members, the consideration of the minutes of the 10th of February is deferred to the next meeting, not during this public hearing. I would like us to leave that one out. And tomorrow we are proceeding. Same venue at 9:30. And indeed, thank you once more. The meeting stands adjourned.